Welcome back, everyone, to day two of Habitat. We're going to turn it right over to Michelle to continue on with George's.
So the plan for today is to talk about habitat management alternatives on George's Bank and then in the Great South Channel in southern New England, and then to talk about the spawning alternatives for George's Bank in southern New England, and then finally those the research area in the southern part of Closed Area 1 that we didn't really get to yesterday. So on George's Bank, there's seven different habitat management alternatives that are analyzed in the EIS. The maps are up on the other screen as the same as yesterday. So no action, similar to the other regions we've looked at, are the existing groundfish year-round closures and the habitat closures. In Closed Area 1 and Closed Area 2, the lightship is in the other region. Alternative 2, again, similar to other regions, is no habitat management areas, so those existing closures would be removed for habitat purposes. They could remain seasonally, say, for spawning purposes, but there would be no specific habitat management areas. Alternative 3 includes just the northern edge area that you can see in the right-hand panel up there, and it could be managed with any of the different fishing restriction options 1 through 4 that we talked about yesterday and are in the earlier slides of your handout. This area is sort of encompasses really the northern part of the existing Closed Area 2 habitat closure. It does go a bit deeper, sort of along the edge of the bank, and it encompasses some areas to the west as well that are currently open to fishing. Alternative 4 is similar to Alternative 3. It also includes an additional gear modification area, sort of over towards George's Shoal and a bit east of there. Alternative 5 is a very large gear modification area that's really most of the northeastern part of George's Bank, up to the Hague Line and out towards the edge of those shoals. And then within that, a subset of it would be designated as a mobile bottom tending gear closure, sort of towards the shallower, more central part of the bank. And finally, alternative 6, A and B, those are the alternatives that we added. I apologize, this map doesn't show it super clearly, and I didn't really have time to make another one, but alternative 6A is the full area, the larger version, so it basically takes the existing closed area and just extends it out to the west. And then alternative 6B is that same area, but there's sort of an alley buffer along the EEZ removed, and that alleyway is 8 nautical miles wide. So, you know, the northern part of the existing habitat closure basically is removed, and the southern part is more or less retained. And again, you could have the different gear options for those areas as well. So of the different alternatives that we've already looked at, more or less our conclusion was that options 1 and 2, option 1 would be restriction on all mobile bottom tending gears. Option 2 would be a restriction on clam dredges, or exempting clam dredges from that restriction, hydraulic clam dredges. There is now hydraulic clam dredging on this part of George's Bank. There's been some experimental work in the last few years, and there's a large exemption area there now. So with testing protocols that are followed, there is the opportunity to clam in this part of George's. Generally, the alternatives, the areas that are more towards the northern edge, really don't overlap that clam resource very much. So generally speaking, options 1 and 2 have fairly similar impacts. In this region, alternative 2, which would remove the different habitat areas and not designate any new ones, plus the alternatives that are really focused on gear options, so alternative 3 with options 3 and 4, alternative 4 with options 3 and 4, and alternative 6A and B with options 3 and 4, generally have fairly negative impacts on the physical, biological environment and also on groundfish, because the sort of conservation benefits of that are likely to probably be about, you know, neutral as compared to no areas and not positive as compared to no action, negative as compared to no action. So those are all sort of similar in terms of their impacts. And then that's where sort of the similarities, I think, between the biological, the ground fish impacts and the physical biological impacts sort of stop. There's a lot of positives on the physical biological side and some negatives on the large mesh ground fish side. And I'm sure Andy could go into sort of more of the details on the large mesh ground fish if we want to talk about it. In general, in terms of the physical and biological impacts, a lot of the complex substrates, cobble boulder areas that we believe are the most vulnerable to fishing based on our modeling work are really on the northern, northeastern part of the bank. And so having closures on the closures that exist currently in closed area 1 for the most part and then the southern parts of closed area 2 really aren't over more vulnerable habitats. And so removing those closures and focusing the closures in vulnerable areas sort of allows for fishing to occur in less vulnerable habitats and isn't displacing fishing potentially onto more vulnerable habitats. So that's why you see some positive impacts in terms of physical and biological environment of taking these action alternatives in terms of having them be either mobile gear closure or a mobile gear closure with a clam exemption. And then depending on the size, the relative sizes and positions of the areas, the impacts are, you know, more positive or negative relative to one another. In particular, you know, alternative 6A, because it's the largest area, it includes all areas that are currently protected and extends that further to the west onto additional substrates that are vulnerable. That would have sort of the greatest positive impacts from the physical biological standpoint. Alternative 6B, because it eliminates a lot of areas that are currently managed and are currently closed to those types of fishing, would have some slightly negative impacts. So it, you know, sort of depends on the trade-offs between existing, really the existing closed area 2 area and some of these new areas. In terms of groundfish, it's sort of a bit different. There's definitely juvenile groundfish in other areas besides just the northern edge. And so that's sort of where you get some of those negative impacts there. Generally, shifting away from no action is going to have positive economic and social benefits, or at least, and the social, we didn't get alternative 6 analyzed in terms of social impacts, so those are all, they're yellow, but they're sort of really, consider them blanks, I guess. And what's really driving positive economic impacts in this region is providing increased access to scallop resources, and so the, you know, the differences between slightly and positive and positive really sort of has to do with the amount of access that's provided. In some cases, you know, we're making the assumption that associated with options 3 and 4, there's some cost there if vessels have to convert to these other ground cables and such. Garrett, who's DePiper, who's the economist on the PDT, is here, and I think he'd be much better suited to answer specific questions about the economic analysis. But by and large, what's really driving net impact assessments in this region is the scallop fishery. And Deirdre is also here. The scallop PDT did some in-depth analysis of the different management areas. I think I mentioned this yesterday. They basically had a couple different approaches looking at short and long-term yield based on mean and median recruitment in the areas. And then there was another approach that we ran for some of the scenarios, not for alternative 6 in particular, but for some of the other areas using the SAMS model that's used in the scallop assessments and in developing scallop management measures. And so some of what the conclusions are in terms of the economic impacts are based on the results of the SAMS model. SAMS obviously is sort of accounting for the fishing mortality definition in terms of the assumptions that go into the different runs. And so Deirdre can explain this probably better, but you know, a takeaway I had from some discussions we've had this week is that how much open area effort you can have, and there's some projections in the impacts analysis and in the EIS, partly relates to how many scallops are in closed areas. So you might expect to see much greater sort of revenues or things from having no management areas or having management areas with only sort of gear modifications where they're completely open to scalloping, but there's sort of less allowance for open area days at sea under those scenarios because you don't have scallops in closed areas quite as much. So, you know, the assumptions inherent to the SAMS model feed into all those projections and make some of the ultimate forecasts of revenue and days at sea and things maybe more similar under some of the different alternatives than you might have expected. And then generally in terms of social impacts, keeping no action is sort of expected to have some basically neutral because it's maintaining existing. But generally the other alternatives are opening areas. So there's, you know, a positive impact of those openings. Certainly something that we do bring up in the EIS is the potential for some gear conflicts. I know that's an issue that will probably be raised later. In particular, the lobster industry, which is using sort of fixed gears and really within closed area 2 versus mobile gears being allowed into that northern part of closed area 2 and how those conflicts might play out. So that's definitely discussed in the social and economic section. And by and large, the protected resources impacts are, you know, not real significant here, maybe slightly negative. So again, if we want to talk about specifics with the economic or the scallop analyses, Deirdre and Garrett are here to talk about those as well.
Thank you, Michelle. Questions? No questions? Sounds like you've done a great job. Okay. Well, Karen puts the underlying motion up. Tom, you had some comments?
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I got a couple questions for Michelle. I think I'll wait a second until Karen gets the motion up on the board because they're sort of specific to the motion. So, Michelle, there's a motion on the board that talks about, I think, adding an alternative that was suggested by the industry and selecting it as a preferred alternative. I got a couple questions because I think there's been some correspondence about that particular alternative. Have you had a chance or has the PDT had a chance to analyze that alternative yet?
No, we haven't.
Have you had a chance to look at it? Can you make any comments about the relative sizes of the two areas that are proposed as compared to the other habitat management areas on Georges?
Yeah, I did look at that because that was an issue we had discussed. So I didn't actually go through and figure out the existing closed area one closures, but the closed area 2 EFH closure that we currently have, that's also the HAPC, the L-shaped one, is these are in kilometers, or 641 square kilometers. The sort of modification that's in this alternative, the more eastern, smaller red area, that's in the industry motion is 277 square kilometers, so it's a little bit smaller than half of the size, and it does, you know, overlap, so some of the existing closed areas would remain closed. There's a couple different alternative 5, and the document has that mobile bottom tending gear closure that's sort of a bit east of what's on the chart now. The one on the chart is what's proposed in the motion. So that area that's on the chart is about 1,000 square kilometers. I calculated 1025. So the existing area that is in the document is about 926 square kilometers. So they're similar in size, with this one being slightly larger. The largest areas by far that are in this subregion would be alternative 6A, which expands the existing closed area, and that's about 1150 square kilometers. So it's roughly twice, it almost doubles the size of the existing closure. Even alternative 6B that removes that alley is larger than the existing closure by about 20%. I think that's really sort of all the areas. The northern edge area is smaller than the existing closure. It sort of shifted north and west, but it's only about 500 square kilometers, so it's about 20% smaller, more than 25, maybe 25% smaller than the existing area.
So if I might try and summarize that, if you combine the two areas of the industry proposal, I think you get like 1025 plus 277, which is close to 1,300 square kilometers. I think that worked out to be larger than the other alternatives. Is that accurate? Slightly larger, perhaps?
Slightly larger than even alternative 6A.
And then my last question is, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the vulnerability in the area. I realize that's starting to get into the analysis, which you told us you hadn't done, but I don't know if you've got any comments there.
I mean, a little bit. definitely these two areas overlap with places that, according to the SASE model, map out as being vulnerable. You know, it would take a little bit more thought to do a thorough comparison of these areas compared to other areas. I think there's even sort of more additional information we're going to want to add to the EIS that we haven't currently considered in terms of comparing vulnerability. But
David.
Yeah, Michelle, in terms of vulnerability, I think you just mentioned that the area to the west proposed by the industry that's in the motion, this vulnerable habitat within it. I assume that some industry members might have presented you with figures showing where the ocean coral hog fishery takes place in that area, surf clam fishery. It was given to me, and it's making me wonder now, since a few individuals have indicated that that area is extremely important for the ocean coral hog fishery, and if that's the case, and about half of the area was designated as spots where the fishery takes place, if that indeed is the case, then doesn't that suggest that much of the area is soft bottom, mud, sand, habitat for quahogs and clams?
Much of the area between closed area 1 and 2 is that exemption area from the PSP closure where they can fish with the testing. And I do think that there, if my memory on the quahog data, and there's some charts in volume 1 that show surf clam and quahog distributions that we could look at if we want. And they definitely overlap that Georgia Shoal area. Basically, the way the seabed looks in these areas is sort of patches of sandier, finer gravels, and then patches of larger gravels. And so my understanding is that the clam fishery would be fishing sort of between the rougher areas. Within any of these areas, there's going to be a mix of habitat types, but as you move off into these shoals, there are sort of larger patches of sand and gravel from what I can tell.
Terry?
Yeah, I actually have that same figure that Dave has, and it seems like around the cultivated shoals, they work northwest, southeast, in between the shoals, in the sandy places, the discrete little areas. So, I don't know. I think that we need to have a conversation today somewhere on what these guys need to do to be able to continue their fishery, and I don't know what that is, but they do fish small, discrete little areas. I'm sure I've seen the same thing that you have, Dave.
Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Dr. Pierce raising this issue because it's probably one of the most important issues for the Mid-Atlantic Council that's on the agenda today. And the chairman of the council wanted to make sure that this council understood our concern about the potential for the ocean quahog fishery to be displaced, particularly in this area. There's two areas of concern because it just did reopen after spending a couple of million dollars worth of money to come up with a PSP protocol that allows the fishery to continue. And we just got some information about where fishing is happening, and it looks to me like you could probably draw some trapezoids in the middle of the important complex bottom habitat in this Georgia Shoal area in particular, and allow that fishery to continue and still protect the majority of the habitat, in fact, all the habitat, perhaps, that's in that area that the council wants to protect as refugia. So I appreciate Dr. Pierce raising this issue. It is an important issue for us.
Okay, we're starting to transition from questions into comments. Are there any more questions? Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Michelle, the proposals that we have up there, can you talk a little bit about how they rate with juvenile groundfish and juvenile groundfish distributions and spawning locations?
Can you give me a little more guidance as to which you want me to compare?
Oh, sure. Perhaps just given the industry alternatives we have before us, how do they fare on your hotspot analysis? And I'm looking at pages basically 252 to 258 in Volume 3.
I don't have the same version you have. First, I want to generalize in terms of juvenile groundfish hotspots. Georgia's Bank, in general, had fewer hotspots than the Gulf of Maine. Some of that can be related to relative stock size. We ran the analysis, the same analysis for both areas at the same time. So when you look at toes that were significantly above average for the time series in that survey, if the Gulf of Maine stock was higher than Georgia's Bank stock, more of those hotspots would end up in the Gulf of Maine, or would show up in the Gulf of Maine, and fewer on Georgia's Bank. We did run a sensitivity analysis with Georgia's Bank alone, and it didn't show up a lot more hotspots than the combined analysis. However, it does give a pretty good feel for where the hotspots occur within Georgia's Bank, given that caveat. The other caveat is that the spring survey may be early with respect to some of the concentrations some groundfish species on the northern part of the bank. In general, the hot spots occurred along the northern edge in deeper water than you see in the two industry proposed areas, or in the southern portion of closed area 2. And I can get into more details if you'd like to know more.
Just to follow up, how do the distribution of juvenile cod, that very important species, how do they compare to the current industry proposals?
Well, most of the juvenile cod hotspots occurred actually in the northeast part of Georgia's Bank, along the edge, many of them in Canada. Rather than haddock, were more distributed a little further to the west during the time in the survey. But I think we have to be careful a little bit in terms of the interpretation of the timing, because the fish are moving seasonally and we don't survey through it continuously throughout the year. But in general, the cod hotspots were generally in deeper water than shown by the that would be represented by the industry proposed areas.
Good. Thank you, Randy.
Further questions? Jim.
Hi, I just wanted to offer my services. If there are questions about surf clam and ocean quahog distributions, I have a lot of experience having done a lot of surveys of those two stocks for about 15 years. So I'm very familiar with where they are on Georgia's Bank. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, going to the audience for comments on the motion on the board. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fishery Survival Fund. I'm going to put on my glasses so I could read my comments so I stay under my 3 minutes. Most importantly, my comments are about the U.S. side of Georgia's Bank, and everybody has to focus, I think, that's what we're talking about. It's from the channel to the Canadian line. I have a lot of experience in this bottom. I designed the clam dredge that Jim used. I did a lot of exploratory clam surveys on Georgia's. I've done a lot of the survey with the scallop dredge, which I designed with the liner all over the bank, and I've certainly done a lot of the bottom trawl surveys on the bank. There's two main features that show up on Georgia's Bank in the U.S. side. Little Georgia's, which the council has totally overlooked, and the cultivator, which is a feature around it. You have Cultivator Shoals. The SASE model lights up both of those. So the SASE model has done a good job in identifying a couple of key features. Up to 30% of Georgia's Bank has been closed since 1995 with no discernible positive effects or any analysis having demonstrated any benefit to this action. There's been no increase in productivity of prey species, no increase in productivity of Georgia's Bank cod or yellowtail. There's been no analysis of the impact of displaced effort, which has probably had a significant impact on cod. We haven't had a good year class of cod on Georgia's Bank since the closures. There's been no economic analysis of the loss to the groundfish industry of haddock. There have been two Georgia's Bank peer-reviewed published studies on the impact of the scallop fishery, and both of them found no impact, that the environmental effects of current and weather are more significant, which almost to me demonstrates that a closure on Georgia's Bank makes no sense. It's very damaging to the local economy. I'll let a lot of other people speak to that, and I'm sure Deirdre could talk about the loss of income. But in 20 years, my estimate is the loss of scallops has been about $2 billion to the economy. Yo-yo cod, which we're talking about, the young of the year cod, the zero to ones, they occur on top of the bank. We had data that was presented back in the survey data from 1982 to 1999, was presented back in 2000. This bottom trawl survey catch of young of the year cod, which is limited because of the 16 trawler, shows they're in shallow water on the bank, which is what all the science shows about the inshore population of cod, 0 to 30 feet. One of the things that you don't see is that the significant topographic features get steeper and steeper as you get shallower on the bank. That's where the cod are. They live in the shell hash. The complex habitat and grounds on Georgia's Bank pretty much are on the Canadian side. That's where the cod primarily spawn. And they swim back and forth. We do not have a year-round population of cod on the U.S. side of Georgia's Bank, as far as I could see. Effort has been displaced from Georgia's Bank to the more important U.S. cod grounds, which is our inshore waters. There's no documented year-round contingent of cod on Georgia's Bank. They swim over to Canada to get harvested. There is no limit to substrate. There's no bottleneck. I mean, a billion haddock fry over the last 10 years demonstrates that there's plenty of habitat for yo-yo fish to survive. There's probably some major problems going out there, but they're probably related to spawning failures and massive predation. And I've already talked about seals. The solution lies in gear. Yet the AP put some gear solutions on a table, and they were rejected. I think we just need to consider seasonal access, you know, to protect spawning, but we need to have access when the fish are present on the U.S. side. The most important two things that bother me the most is when we have a habitat closure, it's like the dark ages.
Tug on your glasses, Ron. You're running over.
Okay. The key thing to remember here is that we don't have a survey for young of the year fish. And the best tool we have out there is a scallop survey dredge. It does the perimeter of the bank. It doesn't go on top of the bank. So we have not discovered where the young of the year cod are on Georgia's. Thank you.
Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Giglione, Northeast Seafood Coalition. We strongly support this. Just wanted to point out some of the thinking that went behind this alternative. Certainly, SASE was one. At the December meeting, the discussion about the lack of a solid SASE-supported model on Georgia's Bank is one that caused us to look at this closely. Also wanted to point out some things for everyone's consideration is that anything east of 6720, which means anything in the existing closed area 2, and south of the triangle, if you look up the area that's open up in the triangle, that entire area is subject to the lobster agreement. It's codified in the lobster rules, and also in our operations plans. We end up with roughly 4 months access total of anything that happens east of the 6720. So you want to keep that in mind, and we don't see that ever expiring the way it is right now. So basically we have access from from November 1st through to June 15th, but then we have the spawning closure February through April right now. So it ends up with just about 130 days of access. The area that we chose on the shoals was specifically to capture as much of the SASE high-scoring blocks as possible. I think the second highest scoring vulnerability block in the whole Georges Bank is in that option. The other really important item that we were looking at here is the economic trade-offs. I think that it's extremely important for what we're doing. The value of the scallops in that area, the scallop, I mean, they can speak for themselves, but the scallop F is not calculated based on the scallops that are contained in the closed area. So that's all additional economic income that would come from that area on the edge. Also on the edge, looking at economic trade-offs, and I'm sure it's impossible for the economists to come up with this, but we can tell you that it's pretty clear to see that 93% of the quota that's been allocated to the Canadians in the sharing agreement has been harvested by the Canadians, their portion. Out of, I believe it's 260 million pounds of quota since 2004 allocated to the Canadians. They've caught 240 million pounds. We've been allocated 160 million pounds. And remember, the distribution of the stock, don't be fooled by the distribution of the stock. Maybe they're all in Canada. We do an annual survey, and we use the annual surveys and the spatial distribution of the surveys to determine the quota. So the reason we get the size of the quota we have is because the survey results are that that's where the haddock are. Yet we've caught 11%. Out of 160 million pounds, we've caught 18 million. So there's a lot of economic potential in that enormous haddock mortality closure called Closed Area 2. And if you can't work the edge and you can't work the Hague line, then you've definitely got your hands tied. So that was the economic value. And then what we gave back was 12-month access areas, which is that huge area in the shoals. That's now 12 months access. There's a lot to give up there for ground fishermen to have that area closed like it is. But we knew that we wanted to offer plenty of square miles because it seems like bigger is better. This ends up being the biggest overall closure, I believe, on Georges Bank. And we believe on the SASE perspective, it's superior. So we strongly support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Gib.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Gib Brogan with Oceana. Come to oppose this motion. Oppose it on a number of grounds. First off, that it hasn't been through the PDT, and to choose this as the preferred alternative to go out for public comment is premature. That there have been some back-of-the-envelope calculations done on things like gross area, but as we've learned all the way through the SASE process, square kilometers shouldn't be the only metric that goes into this one. Also oppose this. Looking at this, it seems that it's been driven by access for the industry to groundfish and continued access for winter flounder and for, as we've heard for years, access to the scallop resource that's out there. But it's not driven by the goals and objectives of the amendment, particularly protection of habitat. That this does not do the job, does not meet the majority of the goals and objectives of the amendment, and can't pass that review. So we oppose this one, and that looking at opening up and providing access to groundfish and scallops can't be the only thing that drives this process. We need to look at the SASE. If we were letting SASE drive this process, this alternative would look a lot different, but it was driven by access for scallops and groundfish, and that can't be the rationale for this. So we oppose this and hope that you'll find something that does meet the goals and objectives. Thank you.
Drew. Thank you. Drew Minkiewicz, Fisheries Survival Fund. We strongly support this motion. Not to sound too much like Jan Brady, but a lot of the discussion has been about groundfish. Can we talk a little bit about scallops, please? From a scallop perspective, let's talk about goals and objectives and what we're talking about here. You have the best of science available to you is a paper by Drs. Hart and Dr. Rago from 2006 that analyzes the effects of the current closures on scallop production and scallop yield. And what that paper very plainly states, which is obviously for a scientific paper, you rarely get something very plainly stated, but this one is very clear on this issue. And it says that there is no increase in scallop recruitment as a result of the closures. Dr. Hart gets very upset when people credit the closures with bringing back the scallop resource. As she says, that is not supported at all by the science. And they also say that permanently closing scallop beds leads to decreased yield in a scallop fishery because you can't harvest them. You don't get any benefit from the production because unlike fish, obviously scallops are sedentary and they don't move around and they don't move outside the boundaries. And so if you lock them up, they're gone. And so they don't produce more young and they don't produce more yield in the fishery. So you're not getting any benefit from locking up scallop beds. So that is what the best science available tells you with regards to scallops. So what we're trying to do here with this proposal is get you a win-win where we have protections for young of the year cod. We have protections for yellowtail flounder. The area in Georgia's Shoals is an important area for yellowtail flounder, especially juveniles with the shell hatch, which the science says is where they like to be. Get you those protections and allow access to large aggregations of scallops that can be harvested quickly with high CPUE, minimizing area swept, which your science also says that is the goal if you really want to minimize habitat impact, minimize area swept. And you do that by increasing CPUE. This is what this alternative does. So you have less bottom time, more benefit to the nation, and you have the habitat areas that protection. And I would take objection to what we just heard. These areas were driven by SASE. Yes, there were compromises with where they could be absolutely placed with some fishing effort, but they were absolutely driven by SASE. Also, I'd like to talk about the economic impacts of the other alternatives. I would note that in your decision document, alternative 6B is noted as a plus economics driven by scallops. Only in the world of fisheries is over a $300 million loss considered a plus. And that's only because we're comparing it to our existing loss of over $500 million with status quo. And if alternative 6A were to be chosen, you're getting up into a loss of over $800 million. And this is just in the scallop fishery. So we need to do better. We can do better. And this is what this opportunity, this option gives us. Thank you.
Judd?
Thank you. Jed Crawford, Pew Charitable Trust. We don't support this motion. Overall, the proposals you're talking about, not just this one, but some of the others in the DEIS, are suggesting overall reduction in the footprint of habitat protection, EFH protection on Georgia's Bank of something on the order of 90%. I think the discussion today is suggesting that that maybe it's time to turn Georgia's Bank over to the scallop industry as a scallop farm, essentially. And we don't support that. Georgia's Bank does a lot of things. There's a lot of research that has been mentioned in various ways. There clearly is evidence of benefits of closed areas on Georgia's Bank. There's peer-reviewed research from Science Center scientists, Steve Murawski on edge effects, and studies demonstrating differences in the way fish feed within closed areas on Georgia's Bank. It's a recent paper by Pereira et al. Looking at the benefits of closed areas for yellowtail flounder. The northern edge of Georgia's Bank is important for lots of things. It is, among other things, the most important, I think, now area for spawning and herring. Herring spawn sticks to the bottom. Herring spend a lot of time on the bottom. And that is, in a sense, one of the engines of the ecosystem in the region. These herring don't just stay on Georgia's Bank, but they feed fish throughout the region. They migrate down into the South Atlantic region as well, or the Mid-Atlantic region, rather. So these are really important considerations. Your own technical analysis points to substantial importance, both along the northern edge and in more southern parts of Georgia's Bank. As far as the kinds of gear and gear modification, people have raised this point many times. Your technical advisors have advised you not to take this approach. The effects of dredging on the bottom, even in sandy and muddy areas, in terms of the impacts on the invertebrate animals that the fish feed on, are well documented in the scientific literature. Were discussed at the September meeting of the Habitat PDT, just as an example, but have been discussed many times. I could give you six published papers on this subject if you wanted to look at them. I'm sure some of you are aware of them. So we don't support this, and hope that you will think again about a vast reduction in the overall protection of habitat on Georgia's Bank. Thank you.
Peter Hughes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Council. My name is Peter Hughes. I'm with Atlantic Cape Fisheries in Cape May, New Jersey. I would like to thank Drew Mankiewicz for his comments. They are outstanding comments, and and Judd might think that closed area 2 is our little playground, but it's not. Or we need economic, or we need access to those areas for the good of the nation. My company is involved in three fisheries in the New England region. We are involved in scallops, first and foremost. We are involved in the groundfish industry, and that we lease our groundfish to sectors in New England. And we're also involved in the clam industry. And I would like to thank Dr. Pierce, Terry Alexander, and Jeff Kalin for bringing that to the attention of the council. And there are a number of areas in the New England region where clam vessels prosecute their industry. There are a number of these areas that are under consideration today that I haven't seen a whole lot of environmental impact or economic impact when it comes to the clam dredge fishery. And I would hope you would remember that as we go forward. And it's not only the area that's currently being discussed in this motion, but there are discrete areas inside that area and other areas that are up for consideration that are considered high-energy areas, sandy areas, where the clam fishery does prosecute its business. There are a lot of unknowns that come with closing an area, but there are some knowns, and that's could be economic devastation to an industry that we haven't given a whole lot of thought about, and that's the clam industry. Thank you very much.
Okay, I've got Erica, Sarah, Peter Taylor, and Greg. Is there anybody else who wants to speak? Oh, okay. We'll start with those four and keep on going. And all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Erica Fuller from Earth Justice. I'm speaking against the industry proposal and in favor of status quo until further alternatives are developed through public comment. All of the alternatives currently under consideration for Georgia's Bank are deficient at this time. You have a mandate to enhance EFH and minimize the adverse effects of fishing to the extent practicable. Practicability requires careful consideration of a number of factors, but the emphasis remains on protecting EFH. It's not an excuse to eliminate potential protection simply because there may be an economic impact on a certain fishery. Status quo is clearly practicable because the scallop fishery continues to make New Bedford the most profitable port in the country under existing habitat protections. We would urge you to support status quo until further alternatives are developed. Thank you.
Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We also do not support this motion. There's a reason why a lot of this discussion is about groundfish, and that's because one of the goals of this amendment is enhancing groundfish productivity. And based on it's a little bit difficult to comment on this proposal per se because we haven't seen any analysis of this proposal, but just looking quickly through the DEIS and looking at the groundfish hotspots, these areas don't seem to encompass any of those hotspots. Groundfish are clearly, cod and yellowtail in particular, are clearly suffering from low biomass on George's Bank, and that needs to be taken into consideration to rebuild those fisheries. And because it is one of the goals of this amendment, and I don't see how these particular areas meet this goal. I do, while I commend the industry for putting forward a proposal that's larger than any of the other proposals that we've seen, a reduction in size in the closed area on George's Bank, considering the poor stock performance of cod and yellowtail, I think is still inadvisable. Thank you.
Peter Taylor.
Yeah, my name is Peter Taylor from Chatham. I'm a fisherman. I don't care about scallops. I do care about codfish. I've been fishing out in the Sliver area for the last 10 years. And if you care about rebuilding codfish, you can't open up that habitat area to the north because that's where all the codfish are. So if you just want to give up on codfish now, which is fine because I know what this is about. This is about a lot of money for scallops, and I can understand that. But if you just want to give up on codfish, then go ahead with this plan because that's where all the codfish are. I know this because I fish out there. Tuna fish in the last bunch of years, the tuna fish have been out there, and we've been out there in the closed area, in that area, chasing tuna fish. You drop a jig down trying to get bait for heron, try to get heron for bait, and all you're catching is juvenile codfish. The place is full of codfish. So, you know, it's simple. I understand the money behind it, but if you want to save codfish, don't open that. Thank you.
Greg.
Got the mic taped here so we can't draw too close to ourselves. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg Cunningham of the Conservation Law Foundation, echoing others' comments. This is premature to be designated as a preferred alternative. We would support this being reviewed in more detail by the PDT. These areas are within SASE LISA clusters. That's reassuring. These areas are not gear modification areas. That is progress. However, though we don't know much about these areas at the moment because they haven't been analyzed, what we do know suggests that this will not result in an improvement for groundfish habitat, and that this will not result in an improvement for protection of critical life stages of fish habitat. So we need to see the final analysis on that, but that's problematic. Equally important is that you consider whether we're designing these closures to succeed or to fail. There has been a lot of discussion throughout this debate about the existing closures and how they were in the wrong places and therefore not functioning, not doing their job, not purposeful. If you believe that, let's ensure that we do it right this time. This proposal, based on what the staff has done to date, generally in that region, suggests that these areas are located in the least vulnerable areas identified in the SASE analysis. The staff dug into the swath of LISA clusters in that northern portion of Georges Bank and if I'm interpreting their analysis correctly, found that the most vulnerable areas trended to the north and the west. Now, the entire area needs to be analyzed. We've suggested that the entire area, including those LISA clusters, is appropriately a closure, in large part to compensate for massive reopenings in the other areas. But that analysis needs to be done, and you need to determine whether we're picking the least beneficial areas of those that have been identified by staff. Is that going to work? Are you doing this just to meet some Magnuson requirement that you have to draw boxes on a map? Are we actually trying to rebuild stocks and improve the fishery and improve the economy and do what's right for the country, as others have said? This could matter. This could make a difference if we do it right. The other question I'd like to pose is, what's the precedent you're going to set if you reopen the northern edge? So we've closed an area. It's been closed for 20 years. And a species in there has done well. Other species in there haven't done quite as well. When species succeed in our closures, are we then going to go in and harvest them? When abundance goes up, when we've met our goal within the Western Gulf of Maine closed area, in 20 years, are we going to reopen that because cod have come back in the Western Gulf of Maine closed area? The precedent here is really poor. We close areas to benefit habitat, then we fish them when there is some abundance within it. Please consider that as you make this decision.
Gentleman in the front.
Thank you. My name's Eric Hess. I'm a hook fisherman. I can't support this motion. I don't think it goes far enough. I own three permits, and primarily they have George's Bank cod quota. That's my primary species of concern. I'm here in my own self-interest. I don't represent a large group, although I think other hook fishermen might agree with me. We would like to stabilize and promote the value of our individual investments. In my case, I didn't pay for my own permit, but it's basically my life's work. And in the absence of a viable fishery, most of the value in my business is tied up in the value of that quota that I hold. Right now, that quota is at something like 7% of what it could be if in the case of a healthy biomass. So I tend to take a longer-term look at the fishery and the value of my investment in the fishery. I would like to see the council choose an alternative that works in the best long-term interest of fishermen and quota holders so that we can all benefit, and not just the people who may derive a short-term benefit from being allowed access to these areas. I guess one of my questions is concerning whether there is confusion on the council as to the importance of habitat where young of the year fish might congregate and habitat where spawning size fish might congregate. As a hook fisherman, we need a fairly healthy aggregation of fish to be successful, and over the years that has included spawning congregations of fish. When we encounter young of the year, or you know, age 2 or 3 codfish, we move off those areas, and generally those are in much shallower areas, like the ones to the south and the shoal areas of George's Bank. But this is also an important consideration later when you talk about the channel. We generally don't fish in the areas that you have included as habitat areas, and to me, I've always been told as a fisherman when I've inquired to the scientist that, you know, what we need to do is set the stage for a cod spawning event similar to what happened with haddock. And I guess removing the restrictions on these areas, to me, means that you're going to also take some large cod that live in those areas. I fished in the haddock sap in closed area 1, and for a few years we caught large cod in there. And we also caught a lot of haddock, so the program was successful in percentage terms, but as time went by, we no longer saw any of those large cod in there. So I think that will be the case, And I know that we only catch a small portion of fish that will look at the kind of bait we have. I think it will be magnified in those other areas. So, again, getting back to a long-term view of the fishery, I think going into these areas and removing those large cod populations will compromise the ability of the stock to have that spawning event that, you know, scientists have talked about for so long. We're not setting the stage for it anymore. We're actually, you know, taking away the stage. So I'd rather see you do something that makes a little bit more sense from a spawning perspective. And you know, maybe there's some way to go in a very restricted way, similar to what's been done in closed Area 1, and take some of the scallops there without a general opening. Thank you.
Dave Borden.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Borden, Atlantic Offshore Lobster Association. On the motion itself, I'd like to speak in opposition to the motion, particularly the point that designates this as the preferred alternative. I think I just remind the council that your last meeting, you spent an entire day discussing the alternatives and in the end reached pretty near unanimous agreement that you didn't want to pick preferred alternatives until you saw the analysis. And that's exactly the same position you're in here. I have no objections to including this in the package of issues that goes forth. I think there should be a absolutely comprehensive evaluation of all of the implications of this particular alternative, and just point out that our members have somewhere on the order of 20 to 30,000 lobster traps in closed area 2 on an annual basis. As Vito indicated, we had the good fortune of working out a mutually beneficial sharing arrangement with the groundfish industry. But the problem here is there's no such agreement with the scallop industry. Now, just so everyone is clear, the two sides have worked on a sharing understanding. The scallop group is, scallop group is represented and organized by Drew, and I've been doing the fulfilling a similar task on the lobster side. We've had a meeting and we've exchanged a lot of different ideas and strategies in terms of developing a sharing agreement, but we don't have one at this time. And I think that's one of the critical components that's absent here. If you put 350 limited access scallop boats in here to catch the resource, there's a lot of valuable resource available. And you mix that in with 20 to 30,000 lobster pots, you're going to have gear conflicts, the likes of which you've probably never seen before. So the key is to either let the industries work out a sharing agreement, bring that back to the process, and avoid all of that, avoid the impacts both on the lobster fishermen and the resource itself. I should note that this area harbors one of the highest concentrations of egg-bearing females anywhere that I know of, and I've done a fair amount of work on that issue, and that is pretty much documented by the NIMS Observer Program. There are periods of time here where 80% of the lobsters are they're being handled are egg-bearing females. So all of those types of considerations, I think, need to be factored into an analysis, and after you look at that analysis, then I think it's the appropriate time to pick a preferred alternative. Thank you.
Jim Oslin.
Jim Oslin, commercial fisherman, groundfish vessel owner from Portland, Maine. I'm generally in support of this option. It came together with many diverse fishermen, and they worked hard, and I was a little bit part of it. And I think it's really a big deal to get that kind of commitment. And I just want to talk a little bit. And I've got probably over 25 years of experience fishing in this area and to the east of this area myself, and another 20 years of experience having vessels that concentrate on that mostly haddock. So I think I know a little bit about this fishery. And I've heard a little bit, you heard me talk a little earlier yesterday that in my estimation, we have missed $500 million worth of production out of the haddock resource on a 2003 year class that was a record year class and has since died of old age. And the scientists confirmed that to me when I was on that council that they died when I asked what happened to that stock. Now we have another year class that's even a bigger record, that the people that we share this area with or share the resource with are capitalizing on and doing very well. Yet we have a disaster. You know, so my question is, what do we rebuild these fish stocks for? If it's not to utilize it and land it, then I just question why we're here. So, but to the idea that you need to protect cod and you need to protect yellowtails in this area, I agree. And we can do that. We have the capability of doing that with gear technology, and we've proven it. My vessels have been very successful when we can get at the haddock, which they do sometimes swim on our side, but not always, to where we can get at them, of catching ratios of 50 to 1. That's 50 to 1 ratios on haddock and very few yellowtail. And, in fact, when the haddock did swim on over to where we could get at them, in 2011, we were fishing 1 hour per day, right, and catching virtually no cod with separated trawls. And 1 hour per day was because we were catching enough haddock to keep our boats busy. We did that for several months. The market responded to it. It was great. Fish swam back into the closed areas, and that's it. Gone. We couldn't get at them, and since they died. So we know that we can do it when we can get on the fish. So right now, we're fishing 24 hours a day, concentrating on cod, because we have nothing else to do. So if you can get us, if we can figure out a way to get us on, and I agree that this area, if it and when it's open, should be selective fishing gear. Unfortunately, despite the way you think, selective fishing gear is not hooks. Hooks have no selectivity in size or cod. That's why they just told you they can't get away from cod with hooks out there. And we know we can get away from cod. We know the Canadians are getting away from cod, but they're catching the haddock. So I urge you to let this motion go forward. And I also urge you to let us start utilizing these resources. That's the only, and one other thing. Any of the other options that I've seen in the document do nothing to enhance our ability to harvest the healthy stocks. Nothing. In fact, they hinder it. And I just question the practicality of that. I mean, this is practical. This will let us get at some healthy stocks of fish. We can, again, still protect the cod, still protect the yellowtails. This is the only way you can go. Thank you.
Gentleman on the back wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Hansen, longtime fisherman. I fished on the northeast peak before the Hague Line went in. I fished there until the access areas were closed. So I have a first-hand knowledge of what's out there. Since that time, I've worked with SMAST and done the drop camera survey, so I still had eyes on the bottom. And one of the things I noticed with the drop cam, when we went in from an open bottom, which has been heavily traveled, into the access area, or the closed area, that you couldn't tell the difference with the camera. The only thing you could tell the difference from was counting the scallops. The bottom looked the same. It actually looked cleaner this last past June when I was in there in the HAPC with less hermit crabs, less growth. It was basically washed sand. Okay? as one of the points that I wanted to make. You know, I have some knowledge of the area. Now, I also participated in a workshop last summer with Andy and Michelle and asked them the question, what we're trying to do. Are we trying to protect the fish, or are we trying to protect the habitat? Now, the answer was we're trying to protect the habitat that has been proven beneficial for spawning activity. Okay, so that's the SASE model. This industry proposal used the SASE model and also sediment maps. Any tool that we had available to us went into drawing these lines. So it's based on science. It's not just drawing a square in the ocean and saying this is where we want to close it. It's based on science, and it's the best available science. There's also studies done right now that show that the impacts from a dredge are no greater than what weather does. And I was out there in the perfect storm fishing in this area, and it was clamshells is what we brought up on deck. No live clams, it was just clamshells. We went back to the area after the storm cleared, and we caught nothing but live clams. The bottom had been turned over so much by one storm that it was totally unrecognizable. So impacts from a dredge are really can't be counted. Now, some of the speakers in front of us have mentioned that the scallop industry doesn't need it because they're already making New Bedford the number one port. You have to remember, the scallop industry is a part-time fishery right now, fishing somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 month with a couple of access area trips. We're relying totally on price for stability. We need a little more stability of product and probably a lower price just to keep the market share. And one of the other commenters earlier today wants to protect the codfish. Now, closed area 2 has been closed for 20 years. If it hasn't protected the codfish yet, I don't see how a continued closure is going to help. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave Borden. Dave Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Wallace, representing the Surf Clam Ocean Quahog Fishery. A number of facts concerning Georges Banks and the clam fishery, I think, would be in order to right now. You're very lucky to have Dr. Weinberg here because he was the chief clam scientist at the Science Center for a number of years, and he started working with Steve Murawski and Fred Serchuk, who preceded him. Both surf clams and ocean quahogs are found in the Mid-Atlantic and in New England. However, at this point in time, more than 40% of both species are found on Georges Banks alone. So, and it was closed for 20 plus years because of the PSP outbreak in 1988, and was formally closed in 1990. A group of industry folks put together a syndicate to work out a deal with the FDA and the National Marine Fisheries Service, EPA, and all the states to come up with a protocol to open Georges Banks under a at-sea testing process, which is currently in operation. The area that is that has been proposed on cultivated shoals and Georgia shoals contains a huge population of surf clams. And a back of the envelope estimate is maybe 280,000 tons of product in Georges Banks, most of it on Cultivator Shoals and Georges Shoals, for surf clams, and they are worth, you know, maybe $500 or $600 million, which we would catch over a number of years, and it's sustainable. Surf clams and ocean cogs are not overfished, and overfishing is not occurring. Then on Little Georges, where most of the ocean cogs are, there's approximately 360,000 metric tons, and that would be worth somewhere also around $600 million. We recognize, or you need to know, that we fish only on high-energy sand. There our dredges do dig into the bottom. However, they recover very quickly, and I had my office send all of you a synopsis of a study done by Steve Morawski and Sirchuk on the recovery of the bottom. I hope you've all had a chance to read it. It indicates that the bottom recovers very quickly, and that the only thing that's really extracted is the clams that live there. And there is some disturbance of the Bethnic community, but that ends up being food for other fish. We have a very high CPU there, so we are covering a very small footprint. And with the small footprint, if we are allowed to continue to fish there, then we have the minimum amount of impact on the environment. Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else who'd like to address council? Well, seeing none, Andy, sorry about that.
Yeah, if you'd like, I can compare the cod survey catches relative to the industry proposal historically and at the present.
Yeah, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
What I'm going to put up here is the survey catches of cod, age 0 and 1, on Georges Bank, relative to the two industry areas. The circles in blue represent number per toe. They're scaled, you know, by size. For 1963 to 1971, the orange circles represent number per toe from 2002 to 2012. You see that there are in both periods there are some presence of high catch toes in the north central portion of closed area one. You can see quite a cluster of toes, high catch toes along the northern edge here in Canada, extending west into the U.S. waters, generally deeper than the industry areas. In the earlier period, I also see some additional catch a little further to the west. That might be due to differences in timing in the survey. The survey was conducted, I think, slightly later in the season, Jim, in the 63-71. And so I think that's related to it. But we have few catches in the industry areas. This is just one species. It's just cod. It'd be a stretch of the imagination. We'd come up with some hot spots in those areas. Thank you.
David.
Yeah, Andy, since you put that up, this point's been made before regarding the fact that the U.S. side of Georgia's Bank is relatively minor in terms of the ecological importance of Georgia's Bank. Most of the valuable habitat, sensitive habitat, I believe, is on the Canadian side, the northern edge of Northeast Peak. I mean, our industry used to fish that, lost it when the World Court gave it to Canada. So do we have any figures, any estimates of the proportion, the percentage of cod, as shown here in the small triangle on our side of the line versus the rest of the extremely valuable northern edge and peak? In other words, are we're a minor player, aren't we, in terms of what's out there?
These data that I have here are both spring and fall surveys. I don't have the information in my back pocket, but I think I would look to the TMGC reports with the sharing and the proportion of survey biomass in each area. That's a little different than abundance of age 0 and 1, however, which can differ. I don't have a swept area, relative swept area estimate of abundance of age 0 and 1. However, there are quite a few high-value toads over here in Canada. Cod might benefit if there's significant there is significant vulnerable substrates in that area. It's something worth looking at.
Okay, my point is we shouldn't deceive ourselves into thinking that all is lost if that proportion of Georgia's Bank on our side is somehow opened up if access is granted. Again, we are a small player, a little fish in a big tank, and the Canadians have the tank and the fish.
Terry.
Yeah, Andy, I see that juveniles. What are the industry's discard rates along the edges out there? I mean, so we regulate juvenile fish by mesh size right now. And nowhere in this habitat amendment does it say that we're going to down the size of the mesh size that we're towing. And so I don't know why we spend so much time concentrating on juvenile fish, because we regulate that with mesh size. And I'm looking at the in the DEIS, Volume 3, page 254, that's showing us juvenile areas for young year fish. And according to our lobster agreement, the areas that we're proposing to open, we would be on the fall side, which there's hardly any catch of juvenile fish. You'd have to look at the fall survey, mostly. Of the 5 months that we're going to be allowed to fish in there, 3.5 of them are on the fall side. So most of the spring, summer juvenile fish go away. Has that been considered?
I think we've been over this point a number of times. The age 0 and 1 fish discard rates in large mesh trawls is very low. We're not trying to reduce mortality on age 0 and 1 fish. We're trying to use the distribution of age 0 and 1 fish as an indicator of where, in this case, cod have been demonstrated to be associated with structured bottom and reliant on it. We're using their distribution to indicate where those bottoms are with respect to the distribution of that species, which is a different perspective than taking the SASE model in terms of where is their vulnerable substrate, no matter where it occurs or what species uses it. In this case, and it's a very important point here, the areas up on the top of the bank, as I recall, the SASE model indicated were a more high-energy environment and therefore less vulnerable. Am I saying that right, Michelle?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And so even though there are some cod here, in the center of the bank. This is why the guidance from the CAT and the Habitat PDT was towards the edge of the bank where there is more vulnerable substrate and the presence of cod.
Derek.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Chairman, if it would be appropriate for me to make my comments on the motion now, or are you still under questions?
We're going to take the last of the council's questions on Andy's image here, then we're going to take a break, and then we'll go into the motion on the board.
Okay.
Frank?
Yes, thank you, Andy. I don't know if I'm sitting too close or if I misunderstood, but I'm looking at the Canadian side, and this definitely looks a little better over there. But if you look on the inshore in Nantucket Shoals, that's the rosiest picture I've seen for codfish from anybody. I mean, it looks like there's more codfish now than we've had back in the 60s and 70s. Am I misreading this? Or where do those fish go? There's a tremendous amount of fish there. We've had no recruitment. We've had nothing. And yet you look at here, and it looks like it's better than it's ever been. Am I missing something, or am I too close, or am I misinterpreting?
I think I would be somewhat cautious with the interpretation, but it is an indicator that the channel area does have a lot of H0 and 1 cod. I wouldn't just look at this chart by itself to draw a conclusion that the overabundance of cod there in the more recent period is an indicator that stock is healthier now than before. It's just one group of cod, you know, H0 and 1, and you know, they disperse as they grow.
Okay, thank you, because I think they definitely dispersed out of the channel.
Doug,
I'm going to pass because my my comment is not on this particular.
Laura. Okay, Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andy, I'm trying to compare the polygons for the industry proposal to the chart on page 178 of the volume 3 of the draft DIS. And it looks to me like the southwestern polygon there lies a little bit to the southwest of the major vulnerability cluster there. Can you display that layer on that map? Or? It looks to me as if it encompasses some of it, but not the main part of it. And I was just wondering if that information could be added to what you have on the projector.
I don't think that we can just put it on top of this chart in the time frame that you'd like to have it in. Do you want?
I don't
know if these were distributed yet. Okay. Two last questions, and we're taking a break. Mary Beth and Jeff.
Thank you. Just to kind of go back to this map that's up on the screen, and it clearly shows some distribution of juvenile cod, but in one sense, you know, where the industry doesn't catch them, they sort of, I guess, hang out here for some life portion. But what's the significance? What's the link to productivity here? I mean, is there a direct link?
I'm sorry, I want to cut the last half of that. The link to productivity is improved growth and survival of cod in less disturbed, vulnerable bottom.
So do we have information in the document that supports that, Andy?
Yes, I believe we do.
Can you give me a reference to that?
Michelle is working on that.
Thanks.
Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was similar, and it was about the seasonality of cod being in that northern edge area, because, you know, if this proposal is successful and provides access to the scallop industry to the northern edge, which I think many of us in the industry and also managers think is critical based on the economic value of it. Would if that does get approved, the next step then would be for the scallop committee to begin to develop an access area in the in that area. And my question is, could that be done on a basis, a seasonal basis, that would eliminate the majority of the concerns about cod being resident there during some portions of their life history stage, forgetting the issue as to whether or not the scallop industry is taking cod fish. But my question is about the seasonality of the cod concerns in that area and the potential for an access area to take that into account and still provide access to the scallop industry. Yeah, that was a question. It was a question about the seasonality of the concern, yes, in the region, and whether that could be addressed through the development of an access area and access to the scallop industry and minimize the concern that some people have about cod in the area.
Right. So in terms of the habitat, adverse effects to the habitat, a lot of the features associated with these habitats have recovery times that are rather lengthy. So you're going to get the best habitat protection with closures that are long-term and year-round, because recovery of some of these structures takes quite a bit of time. Certainly in terms of incidental mortality or things like that on the fish, which is not the primary thing we're trying to do with this amendment, but is sort of wrapped up in it, there could definitely be a benefit of specifying seasons in the right way to avoid when those fish are most commonly there. But in terms of the habitat protection, because many of these structures take years to recover, that's sort of the thinking behind year-round protections rather than seasonal protections, if what you're really focusing on is protecting the structure of the seabed.
Ellen?
Can I follow up?
Yeah, quickly.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'll let it go for now.
Ellen?
I'll be quick, too, and it's going to be beating a dead horse, but Mary Beth asked a question that was really pertinent, and that is, what is the relationship between year 0 to 1 young of the year fish and spawning biomass? That was your question. And this is what I brought up right at the very beginning. On page 200, there's a chart, Gulf of Maine cod, and it cites New England Fishery Science Center publication from the SARC 55, SAW 55, and on the page 81 of that document, it says, there is no well-defined stock recruit with very little relationship between age one recruitment and spawning stock biomass. And I think that is something that's bothering me, that I don't see that age 0 to 1 would be the appropriate age to be protecting. It may be an easier age to protect because of the necessity for that age to have places to hide for a habitat amendment, but I'm not sure that, to me, that this entire amendment is to, the underlying reason for all of this is to increase the spawning stock biomass and the amount of fish that is accessible to this country and the health of the ocean. I don't see the connection between those two. Thank you.
Is that a burning question, Matt? Because I want to wrap this up. There's no such thing as a simple question from you. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Andy, would you mind saving that image and including it in the discussion documents as it goes out to the public? I think, this is an important thing. We've been talking about this quite some time. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, well, it's technically possible.
may I request that it be done, sir?
Okay, thanks for being simple, Matt. Jim, you got last word.
Yeah, on this point that was just raised about the relationship between the spawning stock biomass and recruitment, well, there are Center reports on Georgia's bank cod that shows that there's a strong relationship between spawning stock biomass and recruitment. And before 1994 on Georgia's bank, the average recruitment was above around 40 million to 100 million cod. And since 1994, the spawning stock biomass has been very low. It's at about between 10 and 20% of the biomass target. And the recruitment has been around between 0 and 40 million fish. So it's a decrease from roughly 80 million down to about 20 million on average, with the decrease in spawning stock biomass. So there can be, in some of these places, strong relationships with recruitment. And Georgia's Bank is one example.
Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. We're going to come back to Doug and Laura to tee things off. Okay, welcome back from break. Had a couple hands before we took for break. I'm going to go to Doug Grout first.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Based on the fact that this is a new proposal here, I can't support it as a preferred alternative, but I'd be willing to consider it for inclusion as an alternative if we approve this motion. And my motion is to amend to strike after the word alternative, the words "and" select it as a preferred habitat management alternative. Strike those words is my amendment.
If I can. Seconded by half the table. second, PK. Discussion. Terry.
I'm wondering if Doug would take a friendly to put at the end of the motion not select a preferred for Georgia's Bank at this time.
No, I wouldn't at this point.
Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if in the interim, if there could be any enhancement of the Georgia Shoal option here. If you look closely at the bottom there, which you can't see on that chart, there's a northwest to southeast trending of high-energy sand in the midst of the complex bottom habitat that this amendment would protect, because I think that there's an opportunity, a strategic crafting of the of that option that would still allow access to the area for hydraulic clam dredges. And I wondered if that could be an option that perhaps our staff could work with your staff on to gain more information about the clam industry in that area, what the economic impacts of the displacement in that area would be, and the potential between now and the public hearing process to take a closer look at the Georgia Shoal option and, you know, with consideration, more consideration than has been given to the surf clam industry. Thank you.
Tom.
Yeah, I appreciate what Doug's trying to do here, and I certainly don't appreciate and can't support choosing the underlying motion as the preferred option. But I don't support including it at this time either. And we've had 10 years, and I actually don't think the underlying alternative increases or even provides a reasonable case for being a habitat improvement. And we've got an area out here, the HAPC, which is a tiny slice of closed area 2, existing closed area 2. It just happens to be the right piece of bottom. If we just protected the HAPC out in closed area 2, we'd increase, allow access for something like 85% of the closure, current closure. We'd provide access on the U.S. side to something like 85% of the Hague line, which has been a big issue. People have talked about that. We've got to get on the line to catch those fish. So the HAPC up there, it's important. It's the right bottom. It's been protected, so we don't have to wait for that area to come back before it's providing benefits. And it's relatively small. I don't see this as this motion, this underlying new alternative, as an improvement over that. I mean, I'm not in the camp that bigger is always better. But when you have an effective closure in the right area that's been in place for a long period of time, I think that's the there needs to be an overriding reason why we can't continue to protect that area, and I haven't heard it yet. I really haven't. I mean, to suggest that this area is responsible for the collapse of Georgia's Bank Codfish, I think is disingenuous. I mean, that stock's been overfished for a quarter century. We haven't had good recruitment on that stock for 20 years, right? It's not because we had these closed areas. It's just not. And to suggest that closed areas somehow have diminished this stock, I just don't understand the logic. So I can't support picking a preferred here. I can't support increasing the scale or scope of options that I don't think protect the important bottom up in this section. So I'll be voting. I'll probably abstain on this and vote against this. I think we should send this out. It's been 10 years. We have a decent range of alternatives here in this subregion. Send it out, and we'll get comment on it. Thank you.
Laura.
So I want to speak in support of the motion, so I'm not sure it's appropriate. Terry. Hi.
Yes, ma'am.
I didn't want to speak to the amendment. I wanted to speak to the motion, so I wasn't sure if it was an appropriate time to speak.
This is a motion to amend, but I mean, why don't you speak to the main motion as well?
I want to speak in support of the motion. I also, first of all, I'd like to encourage the analysis when it's being done. I know for whatever reason, despite tremendous success anytime we've introduced gear modifications, whether it's to help turtles, whether it's, you know, in ICAT to help, you know, circle hooks for swordfish, whether it's separator trawls for fishing haddock instead of cod. I mean, we've had remarkable success actually using technology that the 21st century brings. I don't know why we hesitate to it to incorporate it, but I would definitely encourage when we do analyze this alternative to include in the analysis the possibility of using selective gear in this area, because it has been shown that we can target stocks like haddock and not impact stocks like cod and yellowtail. And certainly things like separator trawls do a better job of that than hooks that can't discriminate, and we do have issues with juveniles, which is what the map that Andy had up prior is an issue for. The other thing I wanted to speak about are the practicability concern and the economic impact. When we talk about the Canadians catching tremendous amounts of haddock that has been in the news, it's not just a patriotic thing that we should feel that we should get our share and they're not. It has a real impact, not just in terms of not being able to fish for the fish, the U.S. boats such as, you know, Jimmy's boats not being able to access the fish because they go back, but that fish is all being trucked into our markets. So the small amount that the U.S. Boats are able to catch are seeing their value at market plummet as a result of the haddock fish being the Canadian fish being trucked in. It's happened throughout the end of January, beginning of February, where I think Richie could speak to, I don't think he's here today, but he could speak to the huge, vast amounts of fish that were trucked in by the Canadians. So it really has a greater impact than just us not being able to catch it. It hurts our fishermen in what they are able to land by skewing our markets. And finally, I would definitely agree with what Eric said about scallop market share not having concerns that price is what's keeping it the most valuable, making New Bedford the most valuable port. When I sit in the scallop committee meetings, we talk about the, you know, lower CPUE and that, you know, being concerned about having the access areas open that are open and what it means in terms of habitat. So if we were to able to open areas that have dense populations of scallops, we could actually provide relief in other habitat areas and perhaps provide more supply to the market to ensure that our U.S. scallops maintain market share in a global commodity market. And I know there are those sitting at the table that say that markets are not our concern, but practicability is. And so for all of the reasons that I stated above, I think this alternative should at least be considered. Thank you.
David.
I cannot support the main motion, but I can support this. I'm not prepared to select the industry offered alternative as preferred. There's no analysis. Others have spoken to that issue. It would seem a bit hypocritical to select it as preferred with no analysis behind it, or at least inadequate analysis. But it is an attractive option, frankly. And it's a good faith effort on the part of three major organizations with which we deal all the time. They're always here at meetings. They're always participating, always offering good ideas, comments, and deserved criticism at times. We said, John Bullitt in particular said, got any straw men? Well, they worked on it. They put it together. So not to include it now seems a bit ill-advised, because we'll go to public hearing, and what will they say at the public hearing? These three organizations, the majority of the people in the room representing the fishing industry, they will say, we want that which you didn't put in for analysis. So that would set us back in terms of our timetable and make for a very frustrating set of public hearings. We have enough public hearings that are frustrating, so let's make this as easy as possible. Not that it's going to be easy, but anyways, good faith effort makes a lot of sense. I'm not in the position to pick a preferred right now. There are some alternatives in the document, of course, that are attractive to me, but without having the analysis of this good faith effort by these three major organizations before us, I can't pick a preferred. So I'll support the motion to amend, but I will likely abstain on any motion that would be to select the preferred. Actually, I hope that a motion is made. Maybe I'll make it eventually that we have no preferred for the Georgia's Bank management area.
Terry.
Yeah, I'm going to support the motion to amend, and I would have supported the main motion, but I can see where everybody's coming from, that we don't have the proper analysis in front of us. I think everybody around the table has said it, so I don't need to rehash what the reasons why I'd be voting for this. But and with this new option going in, I don't think we should be picking a preferred now, because we have another option that we haven't had to analyze. So I will be supporting the motion.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am not in favor of either the underlying motion or the desire to include this one in analysis unless we consider the other organizations that have also made a good faith effort to put in a straw man proposal that we have not talked about at all today. It was sidelined from the beginning based upon the procedural decisions that we took yesterday. But on February 20th, CLF of Justice, NRDC, Oceana, and Pew also put in their straw man proposals. And because we deferred to the industry in moving ahead, that those proposals have not received the scrutiny of the discussion, the debate that the industry proposal has. And so I highlight this to reiterate my concerns that I put forward yesterday. I'm not sure if I can have a contingent vote. I know I can't have a contingent vote, but I'll be voting against this motion. I'll be voting against the initial motion unless it's made. I would support a motion for no preferred alternatives to be selected right now, but I'll also be bringing a motion to include for analysis the EDF, CLF, Earth Justice, Oceana, and Pew proposal submitted on 20 February for the Georgia's Bank Northern Edge Georgia's Bank area.
John.
Yeah, I don't want to belabor the point, but I support this motion as well as I'd support not selecting a preferred alternative. It's ironic, at the break, three or four different council members said, hey, you know what, both sides in this issue think this should be analyzed, and let's make a motion. We actually had similar language drafted up, and Doug had the mic first, so he got the first offer. But this is very important that we analyze this based on the testimony. I know yesterday bigger was better. Today maybe it's not. This covers more square kilometers than any other proposal. It's supported by some of the SASE analysis, a reduction in swept area. a lot of benefits to the habitat, and I think at the very least we should send it out as a potential alternative to be analyzed. I know there's going to be impact on staff. However, I know this is a data-rich region. There's been a lot of data put together on George's Bank, unlike other parts of the ocean. So I think I'm comfortable asking the staff to do this further analysis.
PK.
Yeah, well, that leads me into my question, and I mean, I can support the amended motion to have it analyzed, but maybe to Tom, or what does that do to the timeline? I mean, we added something yesterday. We added one variation yesterday, and now we're going to add this, and possibly with another motion, maybe another alternative.
Well, as you pointed out, the day is still young. So I am not sure I can say exactly what adding these alternatives do. There is no doubt that adding this alternative is additional work that we had not planned on completing, and it will slow down getting the document ready for submission to the agency. I doubt that Michelle or Andy is really prepared at this point to try and estimate how much time that's actually going to take. They have to work with the center, and we have to try and work with some of the scallop people to try and get information, and the scallop PDT is starting to get involved in their assessment planning cycle. So we're hoping that the center will provide us the support necessary to do the scallop analyses for any alternatives that are added, but that sometimes is difficult to get their commitment when they're trying to work on an assessment at the same time. So it will slow things down. I don't know if it will delay things beyond our planned early fall vote. We might have a better idea at the end of the day when we see everything that's been added.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't feel the need to repeat what others have already said. I do support the underlying motion. I support the motion to amend, and I think people have stated really good reasons why that is. The one thing I would like to comment on was, there was a reference to the precedent of letting species grow out in a closed area and then going in and harvesting them, and do we want to do that? And so I would say that absolutely we do want to do that. That is the basis of our scallop plan, which is extremely important, and the economic impacts of this region I think we're all aware of. So just wanted to note that letting scallops grow out and going in and catching them is actually good for habitat, minimizes the impact on the bottom, and yes, it is a good idea.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I speak in favor of this motion, which amends the original motion to make it not a preferred option. And in response to some comments from the audience, this is about access, and it will reduce the amount of closed area. I think that's really what the point has always been about, that we've had huge amounts of areas closed for 20 years for purposes that were superseded when we went to quota-based management. And so this has been, how do we, having gone to that, protect habitat and spawning grounds based on science so that we can go about opening these areas and provide access. And so that's what we're doing. And I have listened, especially over the last two or three weeks, to the agency be chastised for not letting the industry have access to haddock and the amounts of money that could have been gotten and the harvest that the Canadians have gotten because their government has allowed them access. And boy, I just never hear that the Canadian industry pays 100% of the cost of observers. I just never hear that from the industry. And, when we asked the industry to pay, the cost of observing, the industry here said, no way. And would have been maybe a different conversation if the industry came and said, you know, we'll pay to get all of this bounty that's out there, but that door was slammed shut, and so that conversation never happened. But when this habitat amendment happens and closed area 2 is open or portions of it open, then access will be open, and that's one of the benefits. So not just scallops, but haddock, and so that's what we're trying to do here: balance access and protection of habitat. Now, in our letter, we had expressed a preference for 6B, although we'd said it would have been nicer to have a narrower alleyway along the Hague line. And the reason we'd expressed a preference for 6B was that it protected some of the HAPC, and the reason for that was it had been closed for 20 years, and we thought even some passes with mobile gear would do some harm there. But I think the proposal submitted by industry is a very serious proposal. I think it's definitely worth consideration, but it hasn't had the analysis. So I concur with everyone, all the justification given by those who've said this is worthy of consideration, and until it gets consideration, shouldn't be a preferred alternative. I think that's there. But I commend the industry for putting the thought into it that they have put into it, and it merits that consideration. I hope some of the issues that have been raised that, given some time, I hope get addressed are the issues of gear conflict between the scallop industry and lobster industry. The scallop industry has worked, as Vito has said and Drew has said, worked out the issues between scallop and groundfish. Perhaps the same thing can be done between scallop and lobster. And I think, as Dave has mentioned, there's some issues on surf clam ocean quahog on this western area that need some addressing. So there's some things that need some work, but I don't see how these aren't solvable. So I think while it's new to the table, and as Tom said, this is going to cost us time, I said yesterday no one wants to take more time, but it's important to get this right, and I think this is a serious proposal. And we're getting close, and if we have to take some more time to get this right, you know, let's take some more time to get it right. This is a serious proposal. I'm grateful for the people who put the effort into putting a serious proposal on the table.
Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to actually go back to Mary Beth's comments. It's something I've thought quite a bit about as we've talked about the value of closures and closed areas. And that is, under what circumstances would we look at a closure, however long after the fact, and judge that it was effective in providing the benefits that we wanted to, and that we would commit to keeping it closed because it was providing those benefits? I mean, we've talked an awful lot about the fact that we have, in some people's minds, ineffective closures, right? So we need to remove those straight away. Now we hear that even if we had a great closure, the most effective spatial management measure ever, that's protecting habitat, that's increasing groundfish productivity, increasing yield, right, that as soon as we realized that we were actually achieving what we set out to do, we'd remove that closure too. So I guess the more I hear that, the more it just begs the question, under what circumstances would we ever look at an area, say it did exactly what we wanted it to do, let's keep it? I don't know that we have an answer to that, and I don't know that it's logically consistent to say there's no range, no context, no conditions in the resource or in our management that would lead us to say this closure is good, let's keep it. And I think it's something that we have to sort of address as we move forward. I think if by luck or skill we correctly identified really important habitat areas and closed them down, that we shouldn't be looking to open them back up at the earliest possible second, the first time we get a decent recruitment event or have a little bit more yield in there or whatever. That's just my comment. It's a general comment, and we can come back to it throughout this process.
Ellen.
I'd like to speak in favor of the amendment and the underlying motion. I think that all too often the industry over the past 40 years has brought proposals to the council, and I've been part of maybe 20 that have been thrown in the trash. And I think that it is really important when they spend this much time to make a really concerted effort at something that looks at the science and has the input from so many different groups, that we give it due diligence and send it out for the public to comment on. I also want to comment on what Tom was talking about. He's talking about adaptive management, and that's what we're talking about here. Right now we're looking at the pieces of the ocean that we have closed, and we're looking at them to see if they are meeting the goals that they were closed for or if the goals that we have now have changed. We have been very poor at adaptive management. One of the big reasons, I think, is that we do not have consistent research to give us the answers that we need to make those management decisions. Now, we need consistent money, and we need organizations that are willing to step up to the plate and do that research. And I know that the Department of Interior and the Department of Agriculture have plans in place that look at every management measure they take in an adaptive way, and that's what we have got to start doing, or we are going to end up with these horrible fights consistently. Thank you.
Are there any further comments on the motion to amend or the underlying motion? Dave?
Yeah, I'll be brief. I wasn't going to speak to this because, you know, over the last 8 years, I've had more than enough opportunities and times to make my wishes known. But I just wanted to completely back what Ellen just said. I think she's exactly right, and this is the reason why I have consistently strongly backed having dedicated habitat research areas. We need much more than that. We need, as Ellen pointed out, we need a structure, an administrative structure to make sure that they're used properly. We have to have a better way of selecting them, but we can't just throw them out because we wind up after 20 years of having an area closed with no clue as to whether it ever did anything useful, whether it ever met its objectives. And for me, that's one of the key elements. You've got to have constant monitoring or you don't know what you've done. And Ellen is exactly right. We spent too much time taking actions that later we had no way of justifying, if we even had a way of justifying them at the beginning. So I just wanted to completely support what she said. Thank you.
Jim?
Yeah, just quickly, this has to do with center support for any additional analyses. I know if Bill Karp were here, he would definitely say that we will have to we'll try to support any additional analyses on this that may be related to additional alternatives that are made by the council at this time. But we are very busy. We have a very busy assessment schedule for this coming year, and we'll have to evaluate the additional work and figure out how much we can devote to it. But we will try to support this. But I wanted to control expectations a little bit too, so that I don't get hung when I go back.
Tom Neese.
Yeah, I appreciate that from comment from Jim. You know, to be real clear for council members, if you look in the analysis of impacts for the scallop fishery, there are two types of analyses that are done for the scallop fishery. One is sort of a long-term, gross macro look, and another is a much more detailed look using the SAMS model. The SAMS model incorporates the scallop management into it. In my opinion, I don't know if Deirdre would second this with me, the SAMS model results are a little bit more detailed and a little bit more likely about what's going to happen, at least under the current management regime, if those rules continue forward. And the difficulty for us is that the SAMS model is very difficult to run with multiple areas, management areas. It's run by, I think, one center scientist, if I'm right, and then that feeds into the Met's economic analysis, and this is the one we're nervous about being able to get because that's also the center scientist who's the key person for the scallop assessment. I had one point that I'll make now and then one point that I'll hopefully the chair will let me make when we get back to the main motion. The other thing that people need to be aware of is just to remind you of our priorities. One of the things that we had hoped to do if we had preferred alternatives was that the scallop PDT sometime later this summer would start thinking about how to modify the scallop access areas based on the preferred alternatives. Recognizing that the preferred alternatives might change in September when the final selection was made. The lack of preferred alternatives on George's Bank is going to mean that they probably will not be able to start that work until the council makes a vote in September. So this may impact any changes to the access areas that are going to result from the habitat amendment and may delay their adoption going forward. This is all a little bit speculative right now, but I just want to make sure people were aware of that because that's a pretty big impact, potential impact on the scallop fishery for fishing year 2015.
Thanks, Tom. Is everybody clear on what we're about to vote on, the motion to amend, which strips the preferred alternative from the underlying motion? Okay. Those who support the motion to amend, please indicate so. And those opposed? And those abstaining? The motion carries 14-1-1. Tom, you have a comment before we vote on the main motion?
Yeah, I guess I just want to make sure for Michelle and Andy's sake, I'm reading the last sentence of the main motion. Measures for the areas are closure to mobile bottom tending gear, groundfish, and scalloping. Just agree to prohibit their own gears at this time. So what we've done with all the habitat most of the habitat management areas anyway, is I think there's actually four alternatives for what the management restrictions are in those areas. One of them is mobile bottom tending gear. One is a mobile bottom tending gear with surf clam dredges allowed. I forget what the other two are. So the question here is, how do you want this to go in the document? We would probably prefer it with one alternative because it makes the writing a little shorter for the measure. But we want to know whether you want this to look like the other ones where you have the four management measure approaches or you just want a specific management measure approach put in at this point. Since it's just to make it clear how you want it to go in the document.
Comments from the council? Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think from the Mid-Atlantic Council's perspective, we would appreciate it if the surf clam dredge option would remain in the document, particularly in the context of the Georgia Shoal closure. Thank you.
Tom.
Yeah, I guess I had the I think this question is an important one. It looks like the measure or the original underlying amendment or motion was specifically written not to create an exemption for clam gear. So maybe it's a question for John Quinn, whether what was your intention and why? It seems conspicuously and intentionally silent on clam dredges.
Sure. As I said yesterday, I put forward the agreed-upon industry proposal from the three groups. There's certainly been a lot of discussion over the last several days over the clam issue. I'm very sympathetic to the issue. I think as we go forward, maybe the much larger area could be reduced down to a discrete area that they could operate in, and I'm supportive of that. But as far as to your question of why I put that, I put forward, as I said yesterday, the agreed-upon proposal from the three commercial groups.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so your vision of this western box is that it would then be subdivided and made smaller?
No, I don't think I said that was my vision. I said that there's been discussion of there's been a gear exemption issue discussion over time, so I did not say that at all. It's not my vision. It's addressing the clam issue in the appropriate way that keeps this area closed, but at the same time, for habitat purposes, it's my understanding there's soft bottom and then there's habitat in that area. So I'd like to try and resolve that, but no, that's not my intention.
Tom.
You know, to be honest, when I looked at the industry proposal, it was a little unclear to me exactly what they were suggesting because they specifically commented on groundfish and scallop gear and not any other mobile gears. So my suggestion here is just to simplify things a little bit for the staff but address the issues is that we'll write it up with option one, which is complete ban of mobile gear, and option two in the document, which is ban of mobile gear but allowing surf clam dredges, and we can get the analyses that way. Does that sound reasonable, Michelle, to you? Okay.
Terry?
Yeah, that was what I was going to suggest. That, you know, I mean, the surf clam industry wasn't involved in coming up with the thing, so they didn't have anybody advocating for them there. So that's why we were silent on surf clams. But I think we're going to be discussing surf clams this afternoon. So.
Mary Beth?
Yeah, I was going to suggest what Tom suggests. I think it is the right outcome, and at least simplifies it for the staff some by taking out three and four.
John.
So but might it be that there'd be a prescribed area where surf clams would be allowed, you know, to defined alleyways that are mud bottom, so it wouldn't be a comprehensive exemption for surf clam.
That parallels from the discussion we had earlier, but Terry.
Yeah, I think, you know, with my discussions with the folks in the audience and the people, maybe Dave Wallace and Peter, that they have discrete areas. You know, I mean, I wanted to have a discussion about that later, and let them advocate for themselves, because I don't know anything about the business. You know what I mean? So.
Tom.
Well, there's a lot going on here between these two tables. Why don't I let Michelle talk first?
Sure. With respect to the discrete areas, I think it would be relatively straightforward, either in this area on the chart now or in some of the channel shoal, Nantucket Shoals areas to define what those boundaries should be. But, you know, the assumption we've sort of made throughout this process is that hydraulic dredges can't operate on the most complex substrate. So I would offer that perhaps defining discrete subareas for clam exemption is making things unnecessarily complicated and, you know, the way the option's written up is just providing an exemption within the entire area, I think would probably provide very similar conservation sort of trade-offs.
Tom.
Without addressing the technical issues, my concern would be this would be incredibly difficult for the staff to do between now and when we want to submit the document without any input through the council. Those are really policy decisions on those areas, and while we could probably work with the industry to identify them, I think it's kind of inappropriate for us to somehow carve up a suggestion that the council passed and not provide the council the opportunity to weigh in on it before we analyze it and take it out to public hearing. I just think that's trouble for us in terms of trying to get this thing done.
Laura.
If I'm hearing Michelle correctly, it sounds like if we amended this, which I don't know if we can amend, maybe I have to wait till this, well, we're back on the main, so I guess we could amend, is to say and include an exemption for the clam dredging would be the easiest way, because you're saying that they're not going to be dredging in the sensitive areas. So to do all sorts of analysis and try to describe discrete areas, it would be cumbersome, and that's what I'm hearing from Tom as well, so that perhaps to have this motion be amended to include an exemption for the clam dredge fishery. Is that?
Well, we already agreed that we would write it up where that would be a possibility. Option two would allow an exemption for the surf clam dredge fishery. So if you're comfortable with that, I don't think we actually need to amend this motion.
Mary Beth?
Well, it seemed to me if we have the analysis for one and two, that's the range in which what this discussion is revolving around. And, you know, so you have total access, total exemption, and that it provides a range. And if through the public hearing process people come forward and think that there's some subset within that, I think we would be in a fine place. I don't see a problem with that.
Ellen.
Well, I agree with Mary Beth, but I do have some reservations about a complete exemption for the entire area for the clam dredge. And I realize that at the moment they're just dredging in soft substrate, but that's not to say they don't develop some mechanism to dredge in other areas in the future. And I just would like to have a little I'm assuming that the service has the ability to put restrictions on and keep them to the soft substrate once it gets to them.
Laura?
I think the industry would respond, and correct me if I'm wrong, people that actually do this for a living, that the clams aren't in the non-sand. They don't live in the coral. So that's why I think we're fighting nature.
Tom.
Yeah, just to follow up, I don't think Ellen's the only person that has reservations about a blanket clam exemption. I mean, the industry proposal could clearly have included and decided not to include a clam exemption, as you know, as it has in other aspects, other parts of the document, particularly the channel. I mean, the clam issue is a really important one, and I think you address it not by slapping what we're calling big closures in areas with large volumes of sand and exempting the clammers. I think you protect the clam fishery by putting these habitat management areas on hard bottom that aren't full of sand and clams. And I think we're making this mistake here, and that's why we're having this conversation about a blanket exemption for clammers. And we're going to have the same conversation in the channel where we've created a sandbox, and now we're faced with the problem of how do we protect the clam fishery from unintended negative consequences of putting the box in the wrong place. I will say later on today, I think you solve that problem by putting the box in the right place, not by exempting clammers. And I think that the reservations that Ellen has about a blanket exemption for this area specifically are shared more broadly by people in the who forwarded the industry proposal, because they very intentionally did not include a blanket exemption for clams out here on Georges.
Jeff.
I think somebody could look, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think somebody could look at the situation and say that the clam industry wasn't part of the discussion, and that is part of the problem. And, you know, why I think where we are at the moment, the posture this council is in, gives us the clam industry an opportunity to make an argument that they should be exempted from the areas that are high-energy sand and can avoid the complex habitat where, as Laura just stated, the clams are not there. So the fact that the agreement doesn't reflect on providing access to the clam industry is about the fact that the clam industry wasn't part of the agreement, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Are there any further comments on the motion as amended? PK.
Well, I just want to make sure what I'm voting on. Because Tom suggested a way. Is that in the motion, or is that just an understood how they're going to analyze it, or should it be amended to say that?
Tom.
Well, I guess you're right. I'm not sure it actually says that in the motion, and perhaps it would be more clear if the motion was amended to say to replace the last sentence with something like, the alternative will be analyzed with options one and two for management measures in the area. That might make it more clear, but.
So is that your motion to amend, PK?
Yes.
I thought so. And Loris, you second it? Okay. Is there discussion on the motion to amend? Seeing none, those who support the motion to amend, please indicate. Those opposed?
Does he have to read it into the
And those abstaining?
Two.
Okay, we're back to the main motion as amended. No more amendments? Okay. Those who support the main motion as amended, please indicate so. And those opposed? The motion carries 13-3. Terry.
I'd like to offer a motion to not pick a preferred alternative on Georgia's Banks.
Seconded by Dave Preble. New motion for the audience. Comments to the motion on the board? Seeing none, we're back to the council. Doug.
I just want to say that I'm going to vote against this just because I think we should at least try. And if we are having difficulty, then I would certainly support this. But to start off right off saying we're not going to pick a preferred alternative, I can't support it at this time.
Other comments? Seeing none. Those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. And those opposed, the motion carries 15-1. Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had a long discussion about Georgia's Bank alternatives, the scientific merit behind them. We've selected one for analysis, to go forward for analysis based upon access. And I think in the interest of fairness to all stakeholders, I'd like to put forward one for analysis that's defined based upon an alternative that has been developed based upon science. The green proposal dated 20 February 2014 lays forward a box on the northern edge that works best for substrate, juvenile, and spawning not just groundfish but also herring. And as such, I would like to move that the council put forward for analysis and inclusion in the DEIS the Georgia's Bank alternative dated 20 February 2014 from CLF, Earth Justice, NRDC, Oceana, and Pew. If I can get a second, I can further justify that.
You seconded, Mark? Seconded by Mark Alexander.
You know, we're tasked with defining essential fish habitat based upon the best science available. I understand the need for access. I do. And I also understand that we need to use science in defining what's going to be best for that access. I think given that we have given a majority of airtime to industry proposals, it's fair for us to put forward a proposal that has been presented by another stakeholder group who has been just as present as industry has, who has been just as constructively engaged throughout the entire length of this process as industry has. And I think it's become incumbent upon us from process at least that we put this forward for analysis. It just seems to be fair. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go to the audience and take three in favor and three opposed. Who wants to speak in favor? Judd. Yeah, Karen, do you have an overview of the proposal that we could put up on the board?
Can you, I'm sorry, Judd Crawford, Pew Charitable Trust. It would be informative if you could show that possibly with Lisa clusters under it. I don't know if that's hard to do, but that was a big part of, it was part of what we considered in this. Well, I agree with what the maker of the motion has said. I think that it's been clear for a long time, clear today, clear in the past, clear in communication from the agency in a letter that was sent in the fall, that Georgia's Bank is problematic from the point of view of meeting the goals and objectives of the amendment and being consistent with at least my understanding of what the Magnuson Act intends in terms of protecting habitat in order to sustain fisheries, to support sustainable fisheries and fishing communities. Whoops. So I would urge you to move a alternative like this forward. I think the, as best I can understand from attending technical meetings and reading technical materials, the analyses, while not complete, certainly much of what would be required to look at for this area is in place. So it shouldn't be, I wouldn't think, a huge lift to look at this. This is a proposal that captures a lot of what's been identified through the SASE analysis along with the LISA clustering technique. It's an analysis that is consistent with a lot of what we've seen today and other work that's based on biological data about the distributions of fish, young and old. It's consistent with what we know about spawning for a number of species. It's an important area, as I said earlier today. It's at this point in time seems to be probably the most important place where huge quantities of Atlantic herring mass up for spawning events and attach their eggs to the bottom. This proposal spans the border between the Georgia's Bank biological region and the Gulf of Maine biological region, so it has the benefit of encompassing a transition zone, which ecologists refer to as an ecotone, where you get pick up more species than in other areas. It's got a lot of advantages, so I would urge you to at least analyze it and see how it stacks up against the goals and objectives of the amendment and the other alternatives that you have in play. Thank you.
Opposed? Drew?
Thank you, Drew Minkiewicz, Fishery Survival Fund. Well, I'll help Garrett get the economic analysis rolling on this one. You can take the M out of millions and put in a B for billions on the economic impact of this proposal. This runs counter to everything we've been trying to do in this amendment as far as creating science-based, tailored, focused approaches on what we're trying to do. This is just close it all. I mean, by this logic, I mean, yes, it just absolutely ignores the totality of the law, which is adverse impacts to extent practicable. People like to leave that clause out of the law, but it's actually in there. It's right there in the middle. And under, I can't imagine under any scenario in what world this would even be considered practicable. So while it's just in for inclusion, I get it for an analysis. What's the point here? What's the point to say we can propose a big box for closure that is in no ways practicable? I mean, what does this add to the debate? And how does this move the process forward? This isn't a serious proposal. This is a proposal just to close everything. And we know that's not where we're going. We know that's not what the science tells us we should be doing. And we know that's not going to meet any practicability standard. So what's the point of this?
Gib.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. I was, during the discussion of the last proposal, Dr. Pierce laid out some criteria for the people that brought the last proposal forward, that they were national organizations, serious organizations that have been involved with the process all along, making a good faith effort to come up with an alternative that meets the goals and objectives of the amendment. We did the exact same thing. And as we heard from the industry, this was not an easy process. Similarly, from our side, it was not an easy process coming up with something that we thought met the goals and objectives of the amendment. And this is what we came up with. And this is not a joke. It is a serious offer or a serious proposal. We think it should be treated seriously, that it should be analyzed rigorously by the PDT, just as the previous proposal that was brought forward by the industry will be rigorously analyzed. Let the numbers sort themselves out. And in the EIS, the job of an EIS is to look at these proposals, come up with the analysis, and then come bring it back to you to make the decision about what alternatives best meet the goals and objectives of the amendment. As I said earlier, the range of alternatives for Georges Bank, in my opinion and in Oceana's opinion, is largely deficient in meeting the needs of this area and the needs of Georges Bank Cod. We, as the conservation community, came up with a very serious proposal that we think addressed those conservation needs. Looking at Georges Bank Cod, that's, I believe the last number was 7% of the biomass target. So there's a serious conservation need that's out there. This addresses it. This should go forward, get the attention of the PDT, and then bring it back to you folks to consider it. But to dismiss it at this point right now is premature. Thanks very much.
Opposed. Okay, Greg, looks like you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg Cunningham with the Conservation Law Foundation. On your chart of VECs, there are actually three other categories other than the social and economic impacts. And I think I could spare staff some time and effort as well by suggesting that with this area, the benefits to the environment, to groundfish, and to protected resources would be off the scale. So the question is, do you have an opportunity to weigh those two? What is the economic impact? What is the benefit to the resource? And ultimately, to the industry, in the form of an economic impact, if we do what the science tells us. And this is what your own science tells us to do. Practicability involves some pain. And if you're not willing to bear the pain that comes with doing the right thing, you're not going to gain the benefit that comes with doing it. So many of these alternatives, including the last industry alternative that you just voted upon, shift away from the vulnerable areas, shift away from where the fish are to avoid the pain. And subsequently, you're not going to gain the benefit. This will involve pain. There is no doubt about it. But I think you need to see what the benefits will be as well. We'd urge you to analyze it. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure where in the law it says that we have to experience pain, but that was an interesting thought. But I think that our job here truly is to balance habitat protection with the economic and social impacts. I mean, that's what the document does. I think that's what what our job is, and that the goal is to do it in such a way that it benefits the nation. I don't think we should analyze alternatives for the sake of doing more analysis. We've all had concerns about the length of time that this has taken, and I do understand we've added one here, but I think because we've added one doesn't justify adding another one. I think the idea of whether something is practical or not is a very important consideration. And we have, a really nice chart. I mean, we've got lots of charts, but the one from the Fisheries Survival Fund that shows the biomass of scallops in nice color makes it very, very clear what this will do. And if you look in the document on page 507, and it shows what the long-term yield of the different alternatives are for the scallop fishery, and you look at 6A, which is about halfway down the page, this is about two times an area that we're talking about relative to yield here. It's extremely substantial. I can't imagine in the end why anybody would ever choose such an alternative. That when we look at the total, you know, biomass on, all along the northern edge, currently inside closed areas and outside closed areas, and say, well, we think that's the best alternative. Let's just close it all, and we're going to leave all those scallops out there. That's just absurd. You know, I just don't see this as a viable alternative, and to simply analyze something for the sake of having it in the document to me is wasting people's time.
David.
Well, you know, this council, all of us, through the mouth of John Bullard, a meeting ago or so, did say, straw man, bring him forward. And as Gibb correctly indicated before in his comments, I did say that when prominent groups that have been involved in all these discussions for such a long time offer up a straw man into which a lot of thought has gone, then we should seriously entertain it. I can't be hypocritical. I've got to be above board on this and say that I would welcome an analysis of this particular alternative, even if it does require time. We said, straw man, come on. If it takes time, it will have to take that time. Conservation Law Foundation, Earth Justice, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Oceana, the Pew Charitable Trust. I mean, come on. I mean, they've been with us since time began, and they've been very constructive and critical over time as well, like the industry has. So they put the oar in the water, and they're stroking hard. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. I don't know whether they're the goose and the industry is the gander or vice versa, but we have to be consistent. And while I'm fairly certain that when the analysis is done, we'll see that the economic impact of this particular alternative will be through the roof and will be a colossal. Let's demonstrate that for the benefit of those who have offered up this proposal and for the benefit of the many thousands of individuals who will, you know, weigh in on this through the public hearing process. Obviously, these groups will contact all of their members and will be getting, you know, a nationwide push for their particular alternative, and that's fine. But the analysis will be there, and we'll be able to judge it based upon its economic impact, which will be tremendous. Now, there may be some very significant and tremendous environmental benefits as well, and that's where we're going to have to make a decision at the public hearing, balance it, and then make the call as to what alternative is best for the Georgia Bank area. So I think that the motion is a reasonable one, and despite the fact that it very likely may move us beyond September for actions on this very important amendment, I feel obliged to support it.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I speak in favor of this motion for same reasons I think that Dave has mentioned. I think it makes a stronger document to send forth to the public for their comment. And I asked people to think about options, to put thought into it. I think the industry put a lot of thought into their proposal. I think the environmental organizations have put a lot of thought into their proposal. Surprise, surprise, they are very different. The industry has decided that they don't want to close any of the northern edge. The environmental organizations have wanted to close almost all of it. A long, long, long time ago, the agency put forth what I called the Goldilocks proposal of, you know, something in the middle. But the council decided to remove that option, so it's not an option for consideration, to my regret. But I think this gives a choice, and this is important for the document. It's important for the people to have that choice. I'm sorry to repeat myself, but we need to be able to measure all these options against the council's goals and objectives. When options are offered up late in the game, whether by NGOs or the industry that haven't been analyzed, you know, we don't know whether they're going to meet goals and objectives. So this gives us a better shot when we conclude our business later today and we get cumulative effects analysis of being able to know that we have something that meets our own goals and objectives, something to choose from. I think that's important. So I think this is, yes, it's one more thing to analyze, but it gives us a better shot at the end of the day of saying we're going to have something that meets our own goals and objectives. So I think this is important to have in the document.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find the logic of the last couple of people to be impeccable. It's important to remember that as important as our relationship is with the industry, and it is important, they are the primary economic stakeholders, our job is to produce the greatest benefit for the nation. And the fisheries is a public resource that's there to benefit the nation. And it's hard for me to imagine that in that scenario or that responsibility that we would blank out any particular stakeholder. So not to belabor this, because I agree with what all of the other people say, so I'm not going to repeat anything, but it should be analyzed. These are SASE LISA identified areas. In fact, this is the crux of the greatest SASE LISA identified area. There have been a lot of claims made for it that have not been verified. We're getting a lot of economics that doesn't constitute data. Everybody's got an economic opinion, but I've found economics to be a very arcane and difficult to understand subject. It should be analyzed economically. And if we're going to have one option to open everything, then we should also have one that closes a whole lot, too, to put the bookends on it. So for all of these reasons, in addition to all of the ones that have been brought up by the last couple of speakers, I think we're just simply talking about a fairness issue here, and it should be done. I have no idea how it's going to turn out because I find some of the analyses to be very obscure and hard to understand. I want to see them. I want to see actual data. And in addition to that, I want to have this done fairly. So as just a fairness issue alone, I agree with the motion.
Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate these organizations bringing this alternative forward. Originally back, I think it was November, when we were originally going to potentially consider preferred alternatives, and we added three or four new alternatives, I was voting against everything because I wanted to get things in. I wanted to move forward with this after how many years we've been working on this. Clearly, the council is not going in that, has not been going in that direction. They've been, we have been amenable to adding new alternatives, several of which have come at this meeting. The only thing that gave me pause in supporting this motion is, as I recall, being on the Habitat Committee, some of this was very similar to something that we've already considered. And as I went to page 130 in volume 3, I noticed that it is very similar, although not exact, to a suite of alternatives we've already considered but rejected. And that gave me pause in supporting this, and if I vote against it, it'll be solely for that reason. But at this point, since we've already included all the other new alternatives, then I may support this one.
Terry.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious. So does this proposal close all fishing in those areas, Matt? Or, I mean, are you going to allow select gear, or is that a closure?
If I may. Okay. The details are laid out in the letter, but it's an alternative habitat management area similar to the other boxes that we've been putting up there and discussing about. So,
Terry.
But I think the last one that we put in had clearly defined goals. A habitat management area doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be any fishing in there. Will there be fishing there is what I'm asking.
Again, I'll defer to the details in the letter, but the issue here is about habitat protecting substrate and spawning and juvenile cod so they can grow through that critical life stage and become spawners. I'm going to defer to the details in the letter. I think that's the best place for me to go right now, the February 20th letter that we received under tab 7A in the correspondence.
Tom Neese.
I'm looking at the letter now, and I don't think it actually says what measures for the habitat management area unless I'm missing it. So my suggestion would be, should this get adopted, that we take the same approach as we did for the other area and we analyze it based on option one and option two. But we can get there after, I don't know where we're at, motion to amend or the main motion.
Terry?
Yeah, I mean, that was why when I read the letter, I didn't see it. I didn't see any proposals there. It was just a box, a habitat management area. I mean, I just think that we need details. I'm probably going to abstain on the vote because it probably should be analyzed. But I don't know how without knowing what they're going to analyze, with just assuming that they're going to allow no bottom tending mobile gear. And if we're trying to protect juveniles, we better not let hooks in there. And then gill nets. So, I mean, it's, I think, sketchy. And I think that's why that wasn't really a straw man, that I saw it as a straw man. I saw it as a letter with a proposal that had no detail to it. That's what I saw when I read the letter.
Tom.
Yeah, I appreciate the intention of this in terms of equity and balance. And I think a lot of people around the table make some good points in terms of being open to it. My standpoint at this meeting has been nothing in, nothing out. And I've been pretty consistent on that. I'd rather see us include alternatives that take a more conservative approach with regards to protecting habitat than the one that we just let in. But I really think we should just nothing in, nothing out. Let's just move this thing through. It's been 10 years. And with that said, I recognize the value of the contribution. I understand why Matt brought it forward and why people are open to it. But that's where I am at this stage in the process.
Laura.
I'm going to agree with Tom, and I don't want to be hypocritical, but, you know, the administrator spoke yesterday about not getting bites at the apple again and again. And if Doug is saying that this has basically been analyzed, considered, and rejected somewhere at some point during the 10-year process, to be putting it back on the table with no details, and potentially delaying the benefits of potentially opening it for the sake of tit for tat. I mean, that, to me, that just is a ton of work and time and potential harm. Again, to harp on the fact that we got an F on our performance here in the Northeast. And so we're going to continue to lock up that haddock. And other species on scallops on Georges, so that we can take a little more time to look at something that's already been looked at and rejected, so we can be fair in the sandbox. I don't know. That just it doesn't seem time efficient or appropriate to me. Thanks.
John Quinn.
I'm going to support this motion. I think fair is fair. When I spoke yesterday about putting forth the industry proposal, I think it was well thought out, put together. I'm a little concerned that I'd maybe a yes, but I'm still confused in reading this letter. Contrary to what the industry supported, I think there's not as much detail to meet a kind of piece of thing together. But, I think it's the right thing to do. I actually think it will strengthen the industry proposal when you see the economic devastation that will happen with this. So I actually think, from my perspective, it's the analysis will be helpful to what I hope occurs. But I think, the interest of fairness and being at the table, as Dr. Pierce said, I'll support this motion.
Dave Pierce.
As I said, I am going to support it. However, there, and I also support what Tom said about option one and option two relative to what gear can be used in, because the proposal as it exists now in the area that has been drawn has the intent of stopping midwater trawling for sea herring on the edge of the bank, and that's stated close to the closing comments on page 11 of the document, where it says, prohibit fishing with mobile gear and any gear capable of catching Atlantic herring in areas where herring aggregate for spawning and where egg mats develop on the seabed, the northern edge. So I think when this is analyzed, we'll see that many of the boxes will drop out because they've included areas where mobile gear fishing, midwater trawling specifically for sea herring, occurs. And that's not going to pass muster. This is about protecting habitat, bottom habitat. And while it can be argued that on occasion midwater trawls they may strike the bottom, that's not what they do. They're midwater trawlers. So that'll all come out in the analysis, I'm sure. So eventually, Mr. Chairman, maybe with your just saying if there's a consensus, we should include what Tom said, just the option one and option two regarding access for gear.
Ellen?
I haven't decided whether I'm going to support this or not, but I'm going to ask that if this does pass and the analysis goes through, that there's an extremely vigorous social impact study done on this. We've been talking about economics, and we've been talking about fishing and habitat. The other part of Magnuson is the social impacts. And as I see this, this is going to have severe social impacts up and down the coast. And I really would appreciate a very serious look at that aspect of the analysis. Thank you.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I deferred to the letter because I think after a day and a half of this and a long day, I did not want to run the risk of mischaracterizing the details, which I will admit are foggy in my head at this point. And so I want to thank Dr. Pierce for bringing that to the fore and understand his issues. Perhaps the options one and two might be the best way, the most expedient way to go forward to help the staff. But I also want to respond to the charges that this is a tit-for-tat measure. It is not a tit-for-tat measure. This is a science-based alternative that was developed based upon the methodologies we've chosen to examine essential fish habitat that we are required by the law to conserve and enhance. Now, is this going to be the final alternative? That is to be determined. NEPA requires us that we provide a range. Right now, we have alternatives in the document that open everything. This does not close everything. This is still a marked reduction in the amount of habitat we have preserved on Georges Bank. So I'm not putting this forward in a tit-for-tat game. This is about equity, yes, but it's also about making sure that when push comes to shove, we've done our job. And I think this proposal does a very good job of ensuring that. Thank you for the time.
Mary Beth.
So the longer this conversation goes on, the more concerned I am. Dr. Pierce just brought up this issue of something in the letter relative to midwater trawls. The maker of the motion doesn't understand the details of the proposal. I have no idea what the details of the proposal are. I don't have a copy of the letter. I did yesterday. I've misplaced it. So I'm not it's not clear that we even know what we're voting on. If we were to include some prohibition on midwater trawls, I agree with David that the gear, you know, when all the analysis has been done for habitat. It is minimal to no impact on the bottom, so egg mats for herring, perhaps it would just be analyzed and you'd say, no, we're not going to do that. But that those kind of economic impacts relative to that gear type and that fishery are not in the document at all at this point. So that's a significant lift on that. Our job is to have a reasonable range of alternatives. And I just do not see this as at all reasonable, at least the parts that I understand, and I clearly don't understand all the parts. And so I just wouldn't encourage us to do it for the sake of doing it. I just do not think that's a good idea. I'm very concerned about the analysis and now extremely concerned about whether or not anybody around the table really understands what we're voting on.
Tom.
So a couple of last speakers kind of brought up some of the points that I think Michelle pointed out to me. And I'm interpreting this, I'm interpreting the language of the letter, the language of the motion to say that what we're talking about here is adopting the Georges Bank part of the letter that's on page 8 of their letter, which describes this area that Andy has on the chart as an area extending from the current HAPC along the northern edge to the west, capturing the Lisa trawl clusters, as well as the herring spawning areas to the north and providing a buffer to the north and south sides of the area. Where I think the motion would benefit is if it was put in clearly what the council wants in the alternative for the management measures. And there have been a few suggestions that were made. I personally would feel more comfortable if it was in the motion because Michelle pointed out to me that the letter in a later page opposes, for example, surf clam dredges in any of the options. So it would be, I think, helpful to us to have whatever it is the council really wants in the motion, in the alternative, actually specified in the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it meets the approval of the seconder, I'd like to put in language that put forward analysis and inclusion in the DS with the north, with regards to options one and options two. I think that would do it. Tom, does that clarify your concerns?
I think so. We'll probably edit it to say with regards to option one and option two for management measures.
You're okay with it, Mark? Okay. Ellen, Terry, PK?
I need to know if this would open this area up to gill netting and longline.
Yes. Terry.
So you want to close an area to protect juvenile fish, but you want to allow longlining in there. That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. We should, if this is a serious proposal, then it should have no gill netting, no longlining in there too. I think because, I mean, one of the rationales for the motion itself was to protect juvenile fish. Nothing's any more indiscriminate on juvenile fish than hooks. So,
PK.
I thank Matt for amending the motion. I think I can support the motion. Just in all due fairness, John said that. And the industry just put something forward, and I think it's only fair that if the NGOs put something forward and they analyze it themselves and thought it was an area that should be looked at, then I think we should look at the analysis of it.
Dave.
Yeah, just for point of clarification, option one and option two refer to bottom-tending mobile gear. That's the option we're talking about here. Then does this apply to – this is the amendment right now has been primarily directed toward benthic habitat. So are we dealing with just bottom-tending mobile gear and options one and option two? That I need to get that clear.
Yes. I mean, I mean these areas to be consistent with all the other areas we've been discussing this week. So just mobile bottom tending gear.
Are there any further comments on the motion? Tom.
At the risk of being repetitious, I think Andy pointed out earlier today that when we're talking about these habitat management areas and identifying them, the purpose is not to prevent removals of age 0 and 1 fish. It is to protect the habitats that are associated with age 0 and 1 fish.
Anybody else? Seeing none, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. And those opposed? And those abstaining? We missed somebody, so could we vote again, please? Those who support the motion, please raise your hands. And those opposed? Okay, yeah, the motion carries 10 to 6. Is there any further business concerning the Georges Bank subregion? Seeing none, Michelle, why don't we do your presentation on the habitat management alternatives for the Great South Channel area, and then break for lunch. Doug.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. There was one point that I wanted to make and not any motions, thank goodness, but it's just concerning the analysis. Number one, I wanted to my favorite graph that was put together by the PDT regarding the reduction in swept area that's occurred since 1996, I think is a very important graph, and I've mentioned this a couple times before, and I know the PDT is working on this, but I think it's important that be expanded beyond the 2009 time frame that it really was, and I really hope that before we go out to public hearing that we can at least get that analysis through 2011 and have that same graph put in there. And then another comment I wanted to make on the analysis, we had a very detailed science-based letter put forward by the Atlantic Offshore Lobster Association with nearly two dozen references that was suggesting that the analysis for lobster and the impacts that this habitat amendment could have, depending on which options are chosen, could go beyond what was we currently have analyzed. And I'd like the PDT to take a good close look at that letter and the points that were made, and look at those references and see if they feel that they can add anything more to the lobster, the offshore lobster section of the document. Thank you.
That doable, Michelle?
Thanks. Okay. So the next section would be the habitat management alternatives in the Great South Channel in southern New England. You want to do the... Sorry. So in this region, there's the no action would be the existing Nantucket Lightship management areas with the groundfish closure and the habitat closure. The habitat closure is shown in red there and the groundfish closure in yellow. There's some different exemptions and access programs in parts of the yellow areas with some of the other Georges Bank groundfish closures that we discussed in the last section. Again, alternative two would be no habitat management areas. Alternatives sort of three, four, five, and six are really kind of a set of the same areas on Cox Ledge, and then the areas in the channel region are sort of progressively shifted to the west and are kind of slightly different sizes around the margins. And so you'll see in the impacts analysis that the fisheries that are more affected kind of shifts with the different areas. So they kind of represent a progression. Alternative 3 is the one that extends furthest to the north and also to the east. And so that's called the either the Great South Channel Expanded or East Area. And so that's shown on the right-hand panel on the screen. Three is definitely east, and four is the Great South Channel area. The figures are right up there. Alternative four basically takes off, it's on the left there, it takes off that northern triangle, and it takes off the eastern strip, and it just would designate the what we're calling the Great South Channel area. Alternative five sort of, again, shifts the area a little bit to the west, so it removes some areas more in the east, and it gets more onto Nantucket Shoals. And then alternative six would basically kind of extend that area a little bit further south to the border of the existing lightship area and all the way west to hug the state waters boundary. And then alternative six also includes a gear modification component more in the eastern part of the channel up, abutting the edge of closed area one. Just been sitting here. You think I could have, like, generally speaking, the physical and biological impacts, the no action areas are really missing a lot of the more complex seabed types and more vulnerable seabed types. So there's sort of a negative effect of continuing with no action because it's sort of putting fishing, potentially displacing fishing effort onto more vulnerable substrates and not allowing fishing into other areas. There are some locations within the no action areas that are sort of a more complex structured substrate, basically the part of the habitat closure that extends above the boundary of the lightship groundfish area. And so removing that area is considered to have sort of a negative impact. So that's why no management areas is considered to have a negative impact. And then sort of as you move from alternative 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 and shift that area to the west, you sort of get onto sandier substrates. You have a greater fraction of sort of sandy substrates. What the economic analysis shows is that you end up with a greater fraction of revenues coming from those areas from the clam fishery as opposed to scallops or groundfish, just as you sort of shift into those other substrates. So there's sort of the greatest positive seabed impacts from alternative 3 with option 1, a little bit less from option 2 if we have the clam exemption, hydraulic clam dredge exemption, and then, you know, sort of slightly positive impacts for alternatives 4 and 5. In terms of the large mesh groundfish impacts, I think one of the big take-homes here is that there's quite a bit of uncertainty associated with evaluating these impacts. There's really very few survey tows as you get into the shallowest waters up on top of the shoals. So it's really difficult. That's why there's a lot of unknowns here. It's difficult to make assessments about the potential benefits of these areas. Definitely alternative 3 sort of comes out the best in terms of groundfish impacts, and that really relates to the presence of juvenile fish sort of along that, you know, eastern northern strip. I know that the EIS specifically looks at juvenile cod catches. I'm not sure if other species were really highlighted there. In terms of the economic impacts, removing the areas would obviously allow the greatest amount of flexibility in terms of fishing locations for scallops and clams and other things. Definitely alternative 3 and, to a lesser extent, alternative 4 overlap some scallop grounds and some clam grounds, and so those would have negative impacts. There's a detailed discussion in sort of the scallop sections about the differences between alternatives 3 and 4. You know, the bulk of the scallop resource in these areas is in the strip that is the difference between alternatives 3 and 4. And as you move to the west, there's fewer and fewer scallops, but more and more clams. protected resources impacts are generally slightly negative for these areas. There are some overlapping measures. I'm not sure the precise boundaries but there's some gillnet seasonal closures that overlap this region and other different requirements, so that sort of mitigates some of the potential negative impacts of reopening areas. So I think those are sort of the major conclusions that I would provide.
Questions for Michelle? Bang up job. Okay. With no questions on this component of the presentation, we're going to take a one-hour lunch and come back and with the underlying motion up on the board.